This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Marius Burke, and on the 9th of June, year 2000, at 11:45 p.m. in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, at the Woodlands Inn. All right, Mr. Burke, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay, well, with going to flight training and went into Navy flight training, and I was given the option to go either Navy or Marine, and decided to go Marine. And went into helicopters, and most of my time in active duty was aboard ship, based out of Jacksonville, North Carolina, and a lot of time in the Caribbean. And my last tour was in Guantanamo Bay. I had a detachment down there and did some special mission work with an H-37, running up and down the coast with electronics equipment and so forth. And, then we went down to, there's an island about 100 miles, I guess, south of Cuba called Navassa Island. It actually belongs to the U.S. Used to have a colony there back in the 1890s, but since been abandoned. So the only thing they had on there were goats that had been left over. But we did some work down there and lost our 14th engine in 2 weeks on the way back, and ended up having to dump our electronics equipment to keep from going in the ocean. And that was pretty much the end of the project anyway, so that took care of it. Shortly thereafter, went back to the States and was getting out. And that's when the missile crisis came to a head. Of course, the day after we finished our project is when they shot down the U-2. And so I ended up being told that I was involuntarily extended, and I'd already checked out, so I checked back in again, and a couple days later they clarified it and said that, well, anybody who was due to get out before the 31st of October would get out. And I think I was scheduled to get out on the 30th of October. So I started checking out, and old CO ended up talking me into extending. And I foolishly said, well, I'll extend if I can go down on the first wave, and, those kind of stupid things that you do when you're young and foolish. And of course, they said, oh yeah, that's no problem. So we went down there and cruised around for about 3 months, and nothing came of it. It was kind of a waste, other than we retrieved the little helicopter. Then I got out and went flying with the reserve squadron in Norfolk, did Line A4s, and went to school with East Carolina and then North Carolina State. And as I was running out of money and looking for a job, I got called by Air America, and seemed like it'd be a good summer job.
Okay.
That's how I ended up over there.
All right. Now, you were in the Marine Corps from 1958 to 1963.
Yeah.
How would you rate the flight training you received? Did you think it was pretty good?
In the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
Navy flight training?
Mm-hmm.
The best. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an 18-month program.
Mm-hmm.
First 4 months are all academics and physical training. And by the time I was done with that, I don't know if I was any smarter, but I was certainly in the best shape of my life. And I thought I was in pretty good shape before I went in. And the flight training, of course, back at that time, they've since changed it, but we had to go through everything. We started flying the T-34, then we went to the T-28, then we went into Twin Beaches. And the last 6 weeks, I went in helicopters. That was my choice. So out of 18 months, I had 6 weeks worth of helicopter training before I went into the fleet.
Now, how was that transition from fixed wing to helicopter? What was the hardest thing about transitioning?
Oh, it really wasn't all that bad. I mean, helicopter is a lot more complex compared to the airplanes. And I went straight from, essentially, our training, flight training, was in a little, you know, Bell 47, a little bubble Bell, right into an H-37 squadron, which was, at that point in time, the largest helicopter in the world. It was a big twin-engine machine. You carry trucks and cars and everything else inside. So that was kind of a challenge, yeah. But it was sort of an elite squadron, and it was very top-heavy with majors and lieutenant colonels, which was kind of the, you know, the squadron in the helicopter side of things for the Marine Corps. And most of these folks were old fighter pilots, and they didn't have a lot of helicopter experience. So it was kind of the blind leading the blind, and within a year, I probably had more time and experience in the machine than anybody else in the unit. And I was suddenly, I was the instructor, and I was supposedly the expert. And realistically, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just kind of learning by feel more than anything else. And but it was a good challenge. Actually, I learned more about flying when I got out and got into the reserves and was flying jets, because the folks there had, you know, thousands of hours, and they knew what they were doing, and they taught me a few things.
Okay. Now, the time you spent in the Caribbean in the late 50s, early 60s, where were you when the Bay of Pigs invasion occurred?
Well, let's see, what time frame would that be?
That would have been just after Kennedy came into office, so early 61.
I'm trying to recall. Most of our time was spent around Vieques, you know, off Puerto Rico, which is where we did our maneuvers and so forth. And then we cruised around during that time, and they never let us do anything. So
okay, so your unit hadn't received any kind of a mission to support that invasion that you were aware of?
Not specifically, but in general.
Okay,
you know, it was, well, yeah, we're here, and if we get the call, we're going in. But that was not very well organized, and, almost like the evacuation of Saigon. It was sort of that type of thing.
What did you think, and what did the members of your unit think when you heard about the invasion and the fact that it failed?
That was pretty disappointing. Yeah. Yeah, we really had hoped that we'd get in there and do something. And, pretty frustrating. And it just seemed like it was just one more political snafu.
Did you wonder why you weren't a more active part of that invasion?
Well, quite frankly, you know, we were so far removed from, you know, the decision makers and all of that, that, you know, you were just there and, you know, you followed orders, and whatever they wanted you to do, you were going to go and do it. And that was about it. So it really wasn't the type of thing where we were on top of how the decisions were being made or anything like that.
And what about the Cuban Missile Crisis, 62? You were, at that point, you were, like you said, you were just about to get out and decided to stay in if you wanted to be on the first wave. Did you guys realize, or did you talk about at the time, the potential for actual nuclear war and potential that a ground invasion might actually trigger?
I don't think anybody seriously thought that there was going to be a nuclear war. It just seemed to be so far out.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was just my thinking anyway.
Okay.
And, you know, we were looking at it as being, I mean, it was a simple invasion, going in there and just doing our thing and mopping up and taking care of business. And, of course, that was the most frustrating part, and it became pretty boring just cruising around in the waters there for a couple of months and nothing happening, particularly for me, since that was the only reason I hung around. You know, by then I was fed up. I was really ready to get out, get on with something.
But the did your unit have anything to do with the turning of the Russian ships back? The confrontations between U.S. and Russian forces on in the Caribbean? Or we actually...
Not that that I recall.
Okay.
I think they probably kept us maybe a little further away, and they just used the smaller ships to handle that part of it. Because we didn't really... I don't recall sighting anyone.
Now, have you heard recently that some of the documentation and some of the information that's come out more recently about the Cuban Missile Crisis is that there were, in fact, 9 short-range ballistic missiles already launchable, ready to go, in Cuba. And Khrushchev had given the crews on the ground orders, if the Americans attack, launch. Have you heard that?
No, actually I haven't.
Oh, okay.
No, that's interesting.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had heard that, or now that you have.
No,
what do you think about that?
and the
proposed assault?
Well, it's probably not real surprising, and certainly, I'm sure the powers that be, they supposedly had that information at the time.
They did not have that information. Kennedy did not know.
Really?
And he was moments away from ordering the launch of the assault, and Khrushchev, that's when Khrushchev backed down. It was at that point.
That's interesting.
It was real brinksmanship. Kennedy didn't realize.
He didn't realize how
how close the
how lucky
Greek
he was,
war
yeah.
took us. All right. Anyway, I was just curious. Okay, so Air America approached you in 1963 to fly for them. How did they approach you?
I just got a call. I don't know. They tracked me down somehow or other.
Uh-huh.
And from Red Dawson there in Washington, Washington office.
Do you think it had anything to do with those last flights you were making in the Cuba area, the Elint and Sigint flights you were making?
Oh, I'm sure it did, because I'm sure those were agency folks that were working with us at the time, and because I don't know what other reason they would just single me out, because they really hadn't hired any helicopter pilots for about a year or so, because at that point in time there wasn't much activity up in Laos. The guys were lucky to fly 10 hours in a month, and they really didn't hire anybody else for almost a year after I got there. So there was like, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 pilots in Udine. And when I showed up on the scene, they weren't particularly happy to see me, because that meant a cut in their hours. You know, they were only getting 10 hours, and here I show up. That was probably going to be 10% of their flying was going to be cut down for what that was worth. And they didn't really understand why I was there. And so that made them suspicious, too. I thought there was probably other ulterior motives. I was there to spy on them or something. But, not much happened. They ended up, I was there for a month or two, and then they sent me to Taipei to get a Chinese license, which was kind of a joke, but we had a Bell 47 that was used for some special stuff, and it was Chinese registered. And the company had a number of airplanes that were Chinese registered, and they had to have a Chinese license. But the irony of it was that when Chenault was there in Taiwan, part of the reward to the Flying Tigers was Civil Air Transport was made the flag carrier of Taiwan. And that was still the case when we were there. And, of course, Taiwan had its own national airline, China Airlines, and there was a lot of resentment over that. And so they were trying to figure out a way of ending that, and one way was not to give Chinese licenses out to folks. So they had great difficulty getting anybody to be able to pass the tests. And for some reason, I did, but it was a two-day ordeal, and you know, they did everything to make it difficult for you. I was out in the CCAA building, which was outside of town in the middle of February. It was cold, rainy, no heat. And they let me use the corner of one of the secretary's desks. And, you know, the typewriter would be running across and all of that. The exam was sort of translated, I guess, from FAA exams and translated into Chinese and then back into English. And they lost something in the translation. And they would have, some of the questions would be completely covered over. But then the next question would be referring to the question that had been covered over. And of course you didn't know what that question was, so you couldn't answer this one. And when I went over to the proctor, they asked him, I said, you know, I don't know how I can answer this because of this. And he says, that's one. I said, one? He says, yeah. You do that one more time and you automatically fail. No cheating allowed. Okay. So, I ended up getting the license anyways. But eventually, I think we got rid of most of the Chinese registry aircraft anyways.
Now, when you first went to work for Air America, and more than likely this probably was linked with that intelligence work that you did, and you let in the last year that you worked in the Marine Corps around Guantanamo Bay, did you have to go through any other specialized training or a background investigation? Or I imagine you already had quite a clearance for that kind of work. But
I think they did their background checks and all of that, which, you know, we're certainly not privy to exactly what that consisted of. But there really wasn't much beyond that other than our in-house flight training, you know, to get prepared. And of course, again, everybody's sitting there saying, well, I'll bet you these guys are the CIA. And so everybody, you know, pretty well figured that one out. But nobody really talked about it. You know, and you weren't supposed to talk about it, and you weren't supposed to talk about anything, you know, that you were doing. And so it was kind of a sort of an Alice in Wonderland type scenario. And there were, you know, different levels of information. You know, as chief pilot, you were privy to a lot more things that were going on. And it was just like with the T-28 program. Nobody talked about it. Supposedly nobody knew who was flying those aircraft, though probably most folks did know. And I mean, you're up there and you're on the radio talking, and you can recognize voices and things like that too. And so a lot of this stuff that, you know, best kept secrets, pretty tough to to keep those that way.
Can you explain a little bit more about that program? What it encompassed?
Well, one of the biggest problems we had, and it had to do, I think, with the degree of secrecy and all that, was people didn't know what we were doing, didn't understand what we were doing, particularly the military, so there's a lot of resentment. And, you know, in the early days, we were the only search and rescue capability in Laos. And because there was no U.S. military folks, you know, speak of on the ground, doing anything like that. And we had great success because, one, we knew the area. And typically, if we were within 30 minutes, if you get in within the first 30 minutes of somebody going down, you had a real good chance of getting them out. But went beyond then, it was tough because then the enemy, they would kind of circle around and wait in ambush and so forth. And, that became tougher. But a lot of times when we'd go out, special missions and things like that, where we really needed to have air support because we were going to some very sensitive, hot areas, and we needed close air support. we couldn't get it. You know, the military wouldn't provide it. Or if they did, it wasn't real good.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one specific instance where really frustrating. And we'd gotten a call that an Air Force pilot who had been shot down some months earlier up near Sam Newark and had been captured. And they got worried that he'd escaped. He made contact with some friendly elements up there. And so we got a call one afternoon, and there was two of us working up in that area. Bobby Nunez was in one helicopter, and I was in the other, flying H-34s. And we had to cross the trail up by Sam Miller. And that was not a good place to be, because they had 37-millimeter radar-controlled guns on trucks running up and down there, along with all other kinds of aircraft and stuff. And it was not a healthy thing to be crossing that road. You could avoid it. So they said, well, we have cover coming in to support you. You're coming off the ship. So we're orbiting to the west of the road, and sure enough, these jets come in. And they said, we don't know what we're supposed to be doing, but we were told to call in this frequency. And I said, well, here's what we'd like you to do. I said, if you'll go ahead and make runs on the road, we'll cut across. The guy came back and he says, who the hell are you? I said, well, that's not really important. What's important is what we're trying to do. And all I heard was, the hell with you. And they often left us. So I couldn't even see straight anymore. I was furious. So we're orbiting, and Bobby, he was way up there, about 10,000 feet, and figuring out what we were going to do. And pretty soon I looked down, and I'd probably gone over the road about 20 times going like this, and we were on the other side of the road. And I said, well, we're here, let's go. So we went out, and we made contact with one group of friendlies, and they didn't have the pilot with them. They said, well, he's with another group. You'll have to come back tomorrow before we can get him to a place where you can get him out. So I was relieved that night and went back home, and came back up the next day. We used our own T-28s to escort our folks in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was really, we didn't have a lot of choice, because if we needed support that we could depend on, then we figured we'd have to do it ourselves. So the group of us that were flying the 28s got trained by the Air Commandos there in Udarn. And, they had removable insignias on the sides, depending on who was flying them, and so forth. But it was nice. We were able to at least talk back to them. Most of the time we didn't have that option.
So when you say removable insignia, you mean like U.S. insignia, Thai insignia,
insignia, or no insignia.
No insignia.
Yeah, that's what we used.
So you could even fly false flag operations where you could, I mean, just because the insignia is on there doesn't mean that's the actual pilot.
Right, yeah.
Now, when you said you make contact in Laos with friendlies, are you talking about the CIA-operated mobile teams or mobile forces?
Yeah, well, it'd be, the Hmong, the Mayos. We always call them the Mayos. It wasn't until we came back to the States they started calling them Hmong.
Uh-huh.
But mostly we worked with the Hmong. And
they were, in essence, also the part of the teams that were set up by the CIA.
Yeah. And, you know, we dropped teams all over the country, up in Vietnam and so forth. They do listening and road watch and all kinds of different things.
Now, when you arrived in 19... You arrived in Udorn in 64?
63.
And you were there by 63. Wow. Yeah. So that was a quick turnaround. What were your primary responsibilities once you got there in Thailand?
Oh, just as a line pilot for about the first year.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of missions did you run that first year or so?
Mm-hmm. pretty much a little bit of everything. We didn't do a whole lot of flying during that first year. Mm-hmm. Probably in 64 it started picking up. Mm-hmm. But
were you running teams into Laos at that point?
Oh yeah, our flying was in Laos. And but we'd support USAID, you know, mm-hmm. refugee relief, food, supplies, and ammo, and things like that to the outposts. But it was pretty low key. Most of what we were doing was just USAID work, you know, helping refugees, and things like that.
Okay. Do you know if the teams you were putting in place, the CIA or civilian-led mobile teams, if they were engaging in operations like Road Watch at that point in 63?
I don't know if we were doing 64? Any of that in 63. There may have been a little bit. You know, it picked up as time went by and as activity picked up, obviously. Yeah.
And what about electronics or signals intelligence? Would you fly birds outfitted with equipment similar to what you had in Cuba?
Well, we had primarily airplanes that were doing things like that. Okay. Photo birds.
Mm-hmm. U-2s?
Well, U-2s, but we had Volpars. Most of this was lower altitude type work. And they did a lot of camera work. You know, it was the primary mission, strictly camera work. And locating, you know, potential drop zones and things like that.
Was the do you know if the film and the intelligence that was gathered and in terms of photo intelligence, was that sent back to the United States? Was that processed in country? Was everything pretty much?
Well, I think they processed it over there, and I think the information they got from it was, you know, obviously was sent back to the States. But they had the capability of doing everything right there.
Yeah.
Both in-house and in conjunction with the Air Force, also.
Okay. So when did things really start to pick up for you at UDORM? Was it 64, 65 time frame?
Yeah, I'd say 64, 65 when things started picking up.
What did you think about the Gulf of Tonkin incident when that occurred? How much did you hear about it?
Not a whole lot. Information over there was pretty slim. You know, communications, we didn't get, you know, a lot of up-to-date stuff. And again, Gulf of Tonkin was far away, and, you know, as far as we were concerned.
But now, from your perspective, it seems like the emphasis on U.S. foreign policy, at least from 63 to 64, 65, the emphasis is on Laos. Or did you see it as part of the bigger picture of Southeast Asia and the Cold War fight against communism? I mean, how did you see where you fit into the big picture and what you were doing out of Thailand?
Well, Laos is looked at as sort of the in-between here. This was the funnel for South Vietnam and all of that. And since, you know, the military was not supposed to be in there, the feeling was that, you know, we were doing an operation up there that was, in terms of dollars and cents, very, very cost effective, a fraction of what they were spending over in Vietnam. And for the most part, we were probably accomplishing a whole lot more. And, you know, if we were only just able to hold things as they were, they felt that was, you know, that was a good investment. But, you know, it would go back and forth depending on the season. You know, rainy season, things just kind of slow down, and in the dry season, things would pick up, and the north would take over land, and then we'd take it back, and, you know, it was kind of a seesaw type thing. But towards the end, I mean, we just inexorably, they were just taking more and more, and It was pretty frustrating.
That's an interesting statement. Say in the 1971 time frame to 1972 time frame, what would your operation, what would you do operationally during the wet season in Laos? I mean, would you start transporting people more frequently, or would especially with in terms of the agency people that were on the ground with the mobile teams and stuff like that?
Well, we would stay pretty busy. I mean, we had obvious limitations with the weather, but you know, the wet season would slow down the other side because, you know, going on the ground was tougher,
right,
for them. So that's where we had a greater advantage, with the air support.
Yes.
In that respect. But really, it was based on seasons as to who was doing more activity. You know, they would kind of prepare for their offensives, and they were generally pretty well organized, and they were right in our doorstep many times. It was just totally amazing where our main base there at 20 Alton at Long Chin, where in the later days it was under siege. I mean, we woke up one morning and nobody even knew there were any tanks in the country, period. And here were two tanks sitting up on the ridge line, point blank shooting down at us. And it was like, where did they come from? How did they get here? And they were probably on the back side of the mountain for maybe a month or so. And when we finally pushed them out, where they found, caves had been carved out, and they had hospitals and everything else set up. Amazing what their capabilities were, even with what they had to work with.
What time period was this?
This would have been in 73, 74.
And in what area?
Up near the Plain de Jars. We were just south of the Plain de Jars, Long Chin. Right there.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, we were under attack almost on a daily basis. They had 130s coming in, rockets, and it was probably Long Chin was one of the busiest airports in the world during that time. I mean, we had something taking off and landing every 20 seconds, it seemed. And, it was interesting.
Were there many collisions, accidents, as a result of that heavy traffic?
No. Amazingly, really there wasn't. And there was one way in and one way out. You couldn't take off this way and you had to come back out the same way. Because there were these limestone cars were right at the end of the runway. There were a couple T-28s that didn't quite get stopped in time and went into the cars. But for all the traffic and, you had Hmong pilots and you had Thai pilots and U.S., whatever, really went pretty good. And we had somewhat of a control tower towards the end, but before that, we didn't. People just knew, well, you get here, you call, and everybody would acknowledge, and you just work around. And the same thing flying en route. There was very little in the way of navigation, and folks would, particularly in the airplanes, they would just climb up to an altitude and say, well, we're heading north, and we're roughly over Readerville Ridge or something like that at 8,000 feet, and somebody else say, well, I'm at 7, and I'm over here, and okay, and, people would just kind of communicate. I can't think of any mid-airs or anything we had through all that time with all that traffic, which pretty remarkable when you consider all the controls we have here in the States and towers and approach and all the rest of it, and all the mid-airs that we have as a result.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about losses due to AAA?
We had a few real significant ones. A lot of our losses, particularly in the helicopters, were from small arms fire. And I'm pretty sure that the other side had teams, snipers, guys that they would position on mountaintops, passes, and so forth, and they had long rifles with scopes and all that. And I think their only mission was to pick off the light planes sneaking through under the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many folks we lost helicopter-wise. In fact, we ended up having to go to two pilots because we lost some where the only rounds that they could find was right between the eyes of the pilot. And we had a couple Stolecraft that got knocked down that way. And we had a couple pilots who were killed that way in the helicopters. And I think in all cases, we had two pilots up front in helicopters, and so that actually saved the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But that was generally our biggest concern, is small arms.
So it wasn't the quad, like the quad 50s or the...
Well, those would certainly get your attention.
Yes, but you were flying lower altitudes. And
depending on where we were.
Okay.
Actually, most of the time we'd try to fly high to stay out of small arms fire. But actually, the thing that saved us for the most part was we had very good intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every time we'd come back from upcountry, we'd debrief with our flight information folks and say, well, yeah, there's bad guys over here now and something over here. We picked up fire over here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty much up to date. And as a result, and it was the same thing over in Vietnam, the military would really get angry because they go in a great big gaggle, you know, low level, and they get all shot up going into some place. And 10 minutes later, here comes an Air America helicopter, just no problem at all. And, you know, I heard comments where they say, well, you guys must have a deal with the other side, you know. They couldn't understand why we weren't getting shot up.
Yeah.
Well, the reason we weren't getting shot up was because, well, we knew that over here, there was enemy gear. So we didn't fly over them, you know. We'd go around where the military just, boom, just wore right on through. And so there's a lot of misunderstandings like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like... you know, the rumors that we were getting $15,000 for every pilot that we picked up. And not the case. But, you know, that generated hard feelings because
mm-hmm.
they felt like, well, the only reason we're doing this is because we were being paid big bucks to do it. When, in fact, in actuality, it cost us money. Because in the early days... typically, we would be flying single pilot, single aircraft. We might be hundreds of miles away from any other aircraft,
mm-hmm.
particularly if we're operating up north. Now, if the military had scheduled some bombing missions or whatever, we'd get called and they'd say, go ahead and shut down and stand by the radio station. We had a few radio stations positioned around the country. And you might sit on the ground for a couple days doing nothing, just waiting. And at that point in time, we didn't get paid for sitting on the ground. The only thing that we got back then was, I think we were getting $5 an hour for flight in denied area instead of the enemy-controlled area. So, if you're sitting on the ground for a couple days when you might ordinarily be flying 10 hours, you were losing money. And then if somebody actually got shot down, you know, they never shot them down in friendly areas. So, all you had to look forward to was going into a pretty unfriendly situation. And we got our $5 an hour for, you know, flight in denied areas.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I think... right to a man, none of us enjoyed doing that, but knowing that that was one of us out there, we'd sure want somebody to come and get us, and, you know, we'd get them, we would. And we had great success. And even after the Air Force came in with their Jolly Greens and their miniguns and all kinds of support, we still picked up probably a great majority of the pilots because... we generally would be right in the area, and we knew the area and the situation where Now, the poor military guys, they come over there for a tour, and just about the time they were figuring out what's what, they get transferred out. And so half the time, our guys would go in and pick up pilots, and on their way out, well, here comes Jolly Greens, and they say, well, land at the nearest friendly strip, and we'll take over from here. And they'd, you know, they take them home and get their air medals and whatevers and go from there.
They would actually get credit for picking up the pilot?
Oh, I'm sure they did, because they're the ones who came back with them, you know. And, I mean, we didn't keep score in any of that stuff. And,
you kept track in your briefings and your debriefings, the pilots that you picked up, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. There's information on that.
Uh-huh.
But there was just that, and a lot of it had to do with the secrecy part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where we couldn't come out and say, well, here, we're publishing this paper for everybody to understand that here's what it is that we do and how we do it and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Which probably would have been helpful, but there was, I think, basically resentment that these guys figured, boy, we're over here, poor us, and those Air America guys who were making all these big bucks and a bunch of smart asses and don't talk to us and think they're hot stuff. And so there was actually resentment. I sat in on a briefing one time where an Air Force briefer was saying, well, if you go down and you see one of those unmarked helicopters, you know, don't get on board. It's one of those damn Air America mercenaries, you know, they're going to make money off you. Nobody ever turned us down.
They called you mercs.
Yeah, that was the attitude that, you know, we were just, there was mercenaries. And sure, I think everybody, you know, like to make money, but you know, we made a heck of a lot more money. We stayed in the States and flown for the airlines. Nobody shooting at us. And I think most of the guys were there because they believed in what they were doing and enjoyed the challenge and the intrigue and all the rest of it.
Well, wasn't that part of the pitch for the job? When you were approached by Air America, you knew that this was going to be work, probably. I mean, how much did you know?
Not a whole lot, quite frankly.
Where are you going to go?
I, at that point in time, was just in the midst of getting over a divorce. That was pretty ugly, and I probably wasn't in the best state of mind. And actually, I'd been approached sometime earlier when I was still in the Marine Corps, and I wouldn't go over there and do that stuff. That's too dangerous. I got a family, and I don't feel that's appropriate. But when they contacted me the second time, I was in a state of mind where I didn't really care. I figured, hey, I go over there, make a few dollars, and go back to school, and if I get bumped off over there, well, that's probably not a big deal either. And I anticipated it being probably a lot worse than it turned out to be for the most part. When I got out there, it was, I got to where I really enjoyed it. I liked the challenge. I liked the people that we were working with. And it was hard to explain. It was like, you know, a runner's high or something like that. When things were going well and we were making progress, it was really a great feeling. And, there were times when I felt, if they just feed and clothe me, I'd do this for nothing, because you just had that good feeling about it, you know, that you were actually accomplishing something. Conversely, it was pretty depressing when things were going the other way and you couldn't do much about it.
Well, that did that ebb and flow? Was that part of the give and take of the fighting between PAVN and the forces on the ground, the dry season versus the wet season? I mean, one of the things that Codename Mule, the author of that book, whose name is escaping me right now,
Parker.
Parker. Yeah, Jim Parker.
Yeah.
One of the things he talks about in his book is there seemed to be this constant give and take. Well, he was there anyway, where you would have, Pavin would take ground during the dry season because that gave them more mobility, as you pointed out, and then during the wet season, with the air superiority, the use of helicopter mobility and things like that, they could then retake that ground. Mm-hmm. So there seemed to be this constant ebb and flow in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And did that sense of elation and depression kind of mirror that, or?
Yeah, it did. It really did. There was always the hidden hope that we'd take the whole country, and that would be it. And considering with the comparatively meager assets that we had to work with compared to what they had over in Vietnam, we probably accomplished a heck of a lot more with far less. Of course, the only thing that counts is the end results, and it was all for naught, unfortunately.
But, well, the use of air power in Laos and in support of the Laos policy, it seems like it was primarily in the support capacity, intelligence gathering, troop transport, not a whole lot of use of air power in the context of that it was used in Vietnam, the B-52s,
a lot of
gunships and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, there wasn't any of that. There were no helicopter gunships per se. They did run some B-52 strikes on occasions, which I don't think did a whole lot. But they had primarily T-28s, and then the Sandys, the A-1s, the air commandos were flying them, and they'd provide some support. But most of that, again, was for primarily missions where we were either infiltrating or exfiltrating teams, as opposed to, an offensive where you were going in and they were doing all this bombing. They did a little bit of it when they had some Thais that were flying up there, and then the Hmong were flying the T-28s, and they were pretty good. They did a pretty good job, but those poor guys, they were there for the duration. And if they were good, it was just like the folks on the ground. There was a couple of commanders up there that were just really outstanding, and they really would go out with the troops. But it was a question of time before they'd get nailed.
These are Lao commanders, or Hmong commanders.
Lao or Hmong or what have you, and eventually just attrition would catch up with them. You expose yourself just so many times, and so towards the end, we were carrying around 12-year-olds. The rifles were bigger than they were, and because they didn't have any more people, they were pretty well decimated, and that was sad.
Well, when you were infiltrating and exfiltrating,
over there and enjoy.
When you were engaging those types of operations, how much of a compartmentalization of information was there? Were you completely aware of the type of mission that they were going on, and when they came back, were you allowed to talk with each other, or was there, did they try to keep that kind of stuff compartmentalized?
It was on a mission-by-mission basis. A lot of times the guys didn't know exactly what the mission was. They knew what the mission was to bring these folks and drop them off. What they were doing there, they didn't know, for the most part.
Okay.
They didn't need to know.
So it was a need-to-know type of scenario?
Pretty much, yeah. There were, the folks at our level in management and so forth, we would sit on the briefings with the agency folks and have a little bigger picture of what was going on, but nobody really gave out more information than anybody needed. And if there was a need to know, and in most cases, all the pilots needed to know was, you're going to go from here to here, and you're going to drop people off, or you're going to pick them up. This is what the situation is around here, and that's it.
Okay.
Let me make a quick stop here. I'll be
right. Let me ask you a quick question about the Lavlung and Thai pilots. Who trained them?
Primarily the air commandos.
And who were they?
Air Force.
Okay. U.S. Air Force pilots.
Yeah, yeah. And they were based out of Utah. They work very closely with us. They were on our side of the base, Air America side.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were kind of like all part of the same group. Good bunch of guys. And we had a very nice little club that we all kind of built there. And that was a big plum for anybody to have access to the club. The Air Commandos was no question. I mean, they had full access. But there was only a select few folks from the regular Air Force people on the other side that had access, because we just simply didn't have, you know, the capabilities of handling more, which got some people's noses out of joint, obviously. But the Air Commandos were good guys. They gave us our training in the T-28s.
Okay.
And their folks maintained the aircraft and everything else. And it was kind of a fun deal, because we had kind of a free rein anytime we wanted to go out and fly, just for efficiency purposes. We wouldn't, I'd go just like this, you know, and just show them a card, and they say, well, that aircraft over there is available, and you just go out and fly. It was kind of neat.
Yeah. And were they were fairly proficient pilots?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were good.
Okay.
Yeah, they were excellent.
What about the language barrier? How was that overcome? Were they taught English, or were the commandos, were they fluent in Laotian or Thai?
No. Most of the pilots that they trained, the Thai or the Laos, were, you know, they had to speak English.
In the Hmong as well?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, that didn't mean that they spoke great English. Mm-hmm. And, obviously, there were communications problems and things like that, too. But the Hmong probably were the best to work with. The Lao pilots, you never knew what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, they didn't understand what you were doing, and they probably wouldn't or couldn't do what you needed them to do. So you never really had a great level of comfort that they were really going to help you out if you needed it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of providing things like close air support,
right.
It wasn't just in the training that the communication problems would exist or occur, but more importantly, when
you're running missions and so on.
When you're running a mission, you need to be able to communicate with that pilot exactly what you
right.
need to want.
Right. I mean, they know how to fly the aircraft.
Right.
They could do that, but to get them to do what you wanted or to understand sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you didn't know whether they didn't understand or they didn't want to understand, mm-hmm. too, but it didn't really make any difference. The end result was the same.
You didn't get the support you needed.
Yeah, yeah.
Any particular incidents that stand out where that happened?
Oh, I can't think of anything, you know, specifically offhand, but in general, it was just, it was sort of an ongoing irritation at times when, you know, you are never really comfortable if you were depending on them. The Hmong pilots were good. And, of course, the greatest comfort level was when you had, the other Air America guys were up there, and, you know, they knew exactly what needed to be done, and you could expect to be taken care of.
Now, to get back to the flags and changing the flags on the aircraft to suit the pilot, we talked earlier about the rules of engagement in Laos, which were similar to the rules of engagement in Vietnam, where they were very restrictive on what American pilots could do.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a way of overcoming some of those restrictions by having Thai or Lao or Hmong pilots fly missions instead? Or were they controlled by the same set of rules?
Oh, hard to say exactly, but for sure, I mean, they were less restricted in what they could do. I mean, say it was their country, they could do whatever they wanted to do. You know, it was a whole different scenario as opposed to we as Americans. And I mean, that was so sensitive, particularly the T-28 program. I mean, that was so super sensitive And of course, the biggest fear was that, you know, one of us would get shot down, and you know, there'd be an international incident. That here we are, bombing, and there were some news stories talking about that. You know, the word got out, obviously, but and I don't know exactly how they ever came to the conclusion to do that, other than the fact that we just absolutely had to have a little better capability to support ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we ran some missions strictly on our own that were, you know, bombing, interdiction, and so forth, as opposed to just simply escorting, you know, aircraft in and out. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty restrictive. And again, because of the sensitivity, it'd be one thing to say, well, all we were doing was supporting and protecting our people, mm-hmm. as opposed to going out of our way to bomb or you know, to attack, mm-hmm. someplace. And I'm sure the powers that be lost a lot of sleep at night just thinking, what the hell am I going to say if that happens and one of these guys gets shot down, mm-hmm. and captured? Fortunately, it didn't happen. So
now would that kind of activity occur? Was this principally in the area around the Planet of Jars and Military Region 2 of Laos? Or?
Probably more so there than any place. But, I mean, we'd go down south in that area. But, you know, the biggest amount of activity generally was up Planet of Jars and that whole area through there.
Mm-hmm. And those missions where you did fly T-28s and engage in interdiction and bombing, were those American pilots or a combination?
Well, we did some of that, very limited, but mm-hmm. Most of that type of stuff was done with you know, the Lao and the Hmong pilots. That they did that on just on a daily basis.
Okay, so they did. So they were able to skirt the restrictive rules of engagements that prevented Americans from flying.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were.
I would say, they weren't tied to the same restrictions that we were, obviously. It was a very small. I don't know how many pilots they had, mm-hmm. maybe half a dozen, right. or something like that. So I mean, there was just a limit to what they had the capability of doing too.
And and of course, the organization itself wasn't equipped to handle multiple missions or a lot of missions. I mean, your primary support did not come in the form of conventional munitions you could load up on attack aircraft. It was primarily for other types of missions, wasn't it? I mean, or did you ever have any problems with getting munitions for your operations?
I'm not sure I understand the question again.
Well, I'm just curious, you know, as far as the overall mission of Air America in Laos was not to fly interdiction or bombing runs.
Oh, no. In fact, the requirements put on us was we were supposedly strictly non-combatants.
Yes.
We were technically not allowed to carry weapons. And for years we had, you know, obviously there were guys that had weapons stashed or got something when they were up there. But we could get in trouble if we were caught with one. Nobody's going to give us any problem up there, but or if you carried one back down with you or something like that, that was pretty much a no-no. Over in Vietnam, it was a similar situation, and I forget, it was probably in the early 70s, we had a C-47 that was going into a strip and it was shot down on final, and they bellied it in a rice paddy, mm-hmm. and nobody was really, I think, badly hurt. But the VC came and killed them all, killed the crew. And they took their uniforms off and put them on. And so when the helicopters came in, they could see, you know, folks with Air America uniforms, and they just opened up on the helicopters and hit a couple more folks before they were able to get out of there. And so there was a real uproar about, hey, These poor guys didn't have a chance. They had nothing to protect themselves with. You know, if they'd had some weapons, they would have had a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. So they finally relented, and if you went out on a mission, you could check out. I think typically it was an Uzi that they would you would check out when you go out to fly. When you came back, you had to check it out.
So in the helicopters, there were no door gunners or anything like that?
Nope. Nope.
Okay, so I guess my question was, or my point was, you didn't have the logistic support for heavy bombing activity. I mean, that wasn't part of the major thrust of your mission. That was not our mission.
And, right. I mean, again, it was one of these things, you know, fighting with one arm tied behind your back. Mm-hmm. We're expected to do dangerous things and go into enemy areas and everything else, but we were not given the wherewithal to, you know, operate like the military would, like you say, with door gunners and machine guns and all that sort of stuff. Now, there were some very specialized, special project missions where they did have something like that, but that was not the norm. And so, yeah, we, you know, we were masquerading that under the umbrella that we were civilians and non-combatants, and so we our best chance for survival was information and knowledge, and just avoiding where the bad guys were as best we could, and for the most part it worked pretty well. Not always, because it was a fluid situation, and things sometimes move faster than the word could get around, too.
Did you? Was there a high rotation of pilots through Hebron and while you were there?
I wouldn't say a high rotation. We had a pretty small group for the first couple of years, and then things started heating up, and we started bringing in a lot of pilots. And one of the problems we had when I got there, flying 34s, we pretty much flew over Gross all the time, and going into very marginal helipads and things like that up in the mountains. It was very demanding work. There wasn't any margin for error. And we had a very small group, very highly skilled, and we were pretty successful getting away with it. As we grew, we got more and more pilots, and some less skilled than others, and that would generally manifest itself in losses. Your guys would crash and burn and so forth, and so it was almost kind of a weeding out process. The weak ones either had to be very lucky or they didn't survive very long. And I mean, folks would get to the point where it just got to them, you know. It was, this is not my cup of tea anymore. I don't want to go up there anymore. And, you know, and they'd leave. And some of them, they'd be gone for 6 months or a year and decide they wanted to come back. Because we had, you know, it was a two-edged sword. We were there for the duration as long as we wanted to be. And We could leave any time we wanted to also. But I know there were some pilots that I think they had families that liked the lifestyle. They liked having maids and that type of thing. They just go out to the club and sit by the pool all day and have a great time. And the thought of coming back to the States and having to do all that work themselves, they were not real interested in doing that. And I think there were pressures put on the husbands that, oh, we don't want to leave here, you know, we like this. And so some of the folks hung on when probably they shouldn't have. And
was there structured R&R for pilots?
Yeah. And again, it depended on the workload, obviously, but everybody, as I'm trying to recall, I think got like 7 days a month of what we call STO, or scheduled time off, where they could just take off, go to Hong Kong or Bangkok or, you know, wherever. And pretty much trying to get everybody that. Mm-hmm. You know, and they would have days off otherwise, but again, it depended on the flying requirements. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you stayed for 3 years, which was considered like the fulfillment of your contract, then you got home leave, which was 3 months. And you got, you know, first class tickets back to your home of record and back. And if you decided to leave, all your household effects would be shipped back and all of that. So that was kind of a cutoff point. If you fulfilled that 3 years, that was sort of like, okay, you completed your contract. And mm-hmm. from there on out, it was just, you know, it was still open-ended. But
what were the toughest missions to fly?
Oh, I would say probably the, well, the extractions, the search and rescue mm-hmm. ones were probably the nastiest. And of course, a lot of the infill, exfill missions, because you know you were going into unknown territory that was known enemy territory, mm-hmm. and you never knew what you might run into. And obviously, when you're going on the SAR missions, you knew that was in an area of high enemy activity, and you know, you were sitting duck out there going in, mm-hmm. and we were extremely fortunate on those. I don't think we lost anybody on a SAR mission as such.
Wow. What about the special missions?
Well, again, these were insertions of teams, mm-hmm. you know, maybe for road watch or electronic surveillance or what have you, or teams that would go in and their mission was to maybe blow something up or whatever.
You said sometimes those aircraft were going off. They would make special dispensation for certain special missions.
What do you mean?
Yeah, I thought you mentioned that sometimes with the special missions, the aircraft would actually be armed. And that, you know,
there was a very select mm-hmm. few special operations type missions where, yeah, they had some.
Can you talk about those at all? Or?
Oh, in general. Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot different from what infills and exfills were. But a lot of it had to do with, you know, one of the missions was planning listening devices mm-hmm. right in close proximity to enemy concentrations. You know, and maybe you drop this thing in the top of a tree, and, you know, this area would be picked out by our Volpars, you know, in their photos, and they'd say, this is where we want this to be dropped. And so we'd go in at night mm-hmm. and insert these things, and quite successful again there, because they were, you know, pretty well planned missions and you know, highly qualified crews, and they worked out fairly well.
And how about motion sensing devices, you know, to try to track troop movements and stuff like that?
Yeah, a lot of things like that. And a lot of stuff that, you know, we didn't even know what they were doing with them. But
mm-hmm. So, again, a compartmentalization of the
information. To some extent, yeah. A lot of times you didn't even want to know. But, yeah, nobody talked more than they needed to. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much the sense. And, you know, and in some respects that was good, and in some respects it was bad. Because sometimes it's better for people to know a little bit more of what's going on and have an understanding and appreciation that, you know, this is something that we probably really need to do mm-hmm. and may have a little better feeling about it, as opposed to, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm. How was morale?
Well, I say morale was excellent. You know, we had, it's curious, there's a lot of people that were there that I probably would not want to necessarily socialize with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, you know, with the group here, but we all have one thing in common. We're all over there doing the same thing, and even folks that maybe I may not feel real warm about, mm-hmm. I have a lot of respect for them because I know what they did and what they would do mm-hmm. when things got tough. And so there's an appreciation and a bond, you know, you might say, between folks that, you know, you would never have mm-hmm. given different sets of circumstances. And pretty much the sense that most everybody would rise to the occasion when things got tough, somebody was in a bind, with few exceptions. You could pretty well depend, but if I'm down there, these guys are going to be making an effort to get me out, and vice versa. So there was that, and I think the fact that we were so grossly misunderstood by the public and the military, that brought us even closer together. And some of the folks that we worked with, well, like Tony Poe was just a jewel. And
he was the CIA station chief in Laos?
Well, he was sort of the original man up there. Pretty legendary. As you go through, you'll hear more and more about him. So Tony was a hard-drinking, hard-living type of guy, but he was a straight shooter. And he expected a lot, but he was always straight. And he would tell you, it's not a problem, you can go in here, this is what you need to do. Or he would say, there shouldn't be a problem, but I'm not 100% certain, I'm going to go with you. Or else he'd say, you're not going to go over there. You know, doesn't make any sense. And so, whatever Tony would say, you know, I'd like you to go here, he didn't question it. You know, and it was, you know, there's always a possibility of an unknown happening, but it was never to his knowledge. Whereas a lot of the folks who came in later years, a lot of the young guys, I don't know whether they're trying to make a name for themselves or what have you, but their attitude was more adversarial. And hey, you know, if you guys are getting paid to do this, what the hell's the matter with you? You know, you just go over there and do it. And you never had the same confidence that, you know, in their mind, you got the feeling that you were expendable. And, you know, you went over in this mission and didn't come back, well, that's the name of the game. And, you know, realistically, we weren't there on suicide missions. You know, we were there for the duration. And unless the odds were stacked in your favor, sure, there's always a risk. But, I mean, you got to take a calculated risk. And if you can, in your own mind, imagine that you're going to be able to go in there and come back out again, it'd make a whole lot of sense to be going. That's not heroism, that's stupidity. And some of these folks, in later years, towards the end, I can remember going up almost on a daily basis because they call down, they say, hey, you got to come up here because the pilots are refusing to go on this mission. And so I'd go up, I'd listen to the brief, and usually it had to do with cover. And it was hard to get cover support, but we had a policy that, you know, if there was no enemy activity where we were going in, we didn't go in there unless we had some cover. Didn't make any sense. And so what they would try to do, if they couldn't get cover, they'd say, not a problem, you know, it's okay. Well, our guys, they knew better, you know, and they'd say, wait a minute, we got activity reports here, 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 and here. This is not a place to be going in. And I would say, you know, 90-95% of the time, I would say, they're right, we're not going to do this unless you get cover. Mm-hmm. You know, well, sometimes they would get cover, and other times he says, hey, we're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of you know, headbutting here, and there was a lot of animosity where the customers felt like, wait, you're America guys, don't want to do anything. And that wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm. And these were the successors to Tony Pope?
Yeah, some. No, selected ones, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of other good guys that, Digger O'Dell and folks like that, that were straight shooters, professional, and really, we worked well with. But then there are others that you didn't have that same level of confidence. And, you run into that any place.
Right. Now, when you needed cover and when you were supplied cover, this is Air Force and Navy cover? Primarily?
Yeah, primarily Air Force. Sometimes it would be Navy, ships off the carriers.
Any other incidents like the one during that SAR mission? Where you had, again, conflict with the Navy or Air Force pilots?
That's the only one that really sticks in my mind. The biggest problem we had for the most part was just simply getting the cover. And when the Air Force came in with their Jolly Greens and UDARN, what they ended up doing was they would frag the missions using the Air Force machines, knowing that a great majority of the times they wouldn't make it. For whatever reason, pilots were sick, or maintenance problems, or weather, or what have you. So then we'd be the backups, and we would go. Well, the fact that it had been fragged in conjunction with the Air Force, they could get the cover. So we would then have cover. So I think pretty much all those missions were being made in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we were the primary ones, chances were that we wouldn't get the cover.
And when you did receive cover, it was good or adequate for the job? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, if we had it, those guys, they were good. And it was mostly the best cover, obviously, is with the A1s.
Mm-hmm.
And, those guys were good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned sickness. What were the biggest problems in terms of illness facing you and other pilots?
Dysentery. Yeah. We had some guys had dysentery the whole time they were over there. Hey, howdy.
How are you?
What was the most, for lack of a better adjective, the most brave thing you saw while serving Laos, flying over Laos? What was the bravest action you witnessed?
Oh, there were so many. There was one, and I think I've got the right. I've got some after action reports that you might find interesting, and that I've written, and some other folks, but one I know was up in the plains, and French Smith, who's no longer with us, was flying and with one of the customers, and that was a real sensitive thing about the American customers going on any kind of hazardous mission, because that was really bad news, if they would ever get caught, and so they weren't supposed to go. But anyways, they were flying somewhere around the plane to Jars, and they got shot down. And right in the middle of I think it was a North Vietnamese battalion or something like that, right there. And they leaped out of the helicopter, and fortunately, the customer had some weapons, and they kind of kept folks at bay for a short period. And one of our other pilots, Mick Trullier, was in a 34, and he was in the area, and I heard him call in there Mayday, and I don't know how to put it. Mick was not known to be, a particularly aggressive type of person, but he rose to the occasion, And he swooped in right in the middle of this whole thing and managed to pull them all out, get them out of there. I mean, that was, and that was probably a very good example of, from one end of the spectrum to the other, pretty much you could pretty well count on the guys to look after each other and do it. And Mick just really did just a super, super, super job. And I think I may have a copy of that little report that French wrote up, which would probably be interesting reading.
How many Air America pilots were lost while you were there? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. Well, they should have the exact number. They've got them on the our little wall. Yeah, in just a couple of minutes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, give me a couple of minutes. I know, I think in the last 2 years we lost, last year or so, I think we lost something like 70 pilots in 1 year. And but they've got an exact account down there at University of Texas there in Dallas. They've got a plaque that's got...
Okay. All the names.
There's a lot of names on there, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then when you finished in...
I actually... just went over there strictly as a line pilot with the intent of I'd ship my family back to the States and I was just going to go over there for the sort of the duration. Really the plan was that Air America had become somewhat notorious and that they were going to pull out and I think the plan was for Evergreen Helicopters were going to take over the operation like supposedly in June of 75, and I figured that's probably a good time for me to leave. Of course, we never quite got to that point. And so I flew out of Saigon for some months, and then I went up to Da Nang to take over as base manager there in the absence of Frank Sturgar, who was on home leave. And in the process, Da Nang fell, so I got involved right in the middle of that.
When was that? Was that?
Well, that would have been probably in late March, early April of
March 75.
Yeah. What may be helpful, I've got a couple after-action reports that I wrote up on Da Nang and Da Trang and Saigon that probably goes into pretty good detail of what transpired. And that might be more enlightening than anything.
Yes, sir.
And so they sent me, I went back to Saigon, and a few days later they wanted me to go up to Da Trang to sort of look after operations there. And I got there about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and by 9 o'clock that night I was back in Saigon. Things went that fast. And from there I was kind of given the job to work on the civilian plan, and because of the difficulties we'd had in getting people out of the crowds and so forth, that's when we came up with the plan, the rooftop helipads, so we worked on getting those set up. And I'd say they worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And that was because of the mods that you encountered.
Right.
Going into...
We needed to be able to get our people segmented into areas that we knew where they were at, because everybody lived all over the place, you know, and there's no way in the world you could get to them. And access for the base was always a question. You never knew if you were going to be able to get to the front gate, depending on what the Vietnamese decided. So that wasn't a very good option. So really the only good option was... to overfly, but you had to be able to find and get to the people.
Yeah. And when was your last flight out of Vietnam?
Well, 29th of April, probably, I don't know, 11 o'clock that night. I started flying, I think, at 4:30 in the morning, and I got caught aboard ship the night before because Saigon had been attacked, and they were shooting at anything in the sky. and it was dark, and they said, don't come up here because they'll probably shoot you down. So I ended up almost running out of fuel. We finally found a ship out there in the dark and spent the night and came back in first thing the next morning. It was a long day.
Mm-hmm. And you think you were the last, you flew the last civilian mission out of Vietnam?
Yeah, I would think so, because when I went in the last flight, it was really eerie because all the previous flights, I mean, there was so much air traffic, you know, and on the radio, everybody talking and aircraft coming and going. And I went on this one and I said, gee, something's strange. And I realized there wasn't anybody in the air. I was about the only one there. And I know the Marine Corps came in, you know, subsequent to that and made some flights afterwards. But at that point, they'd shut everybody else down and on the ships. And it was kind of eerie. In fact, I stopped by the Air America ramp. I had a full load of people, and to see if there was anybody or anything there. And there was our Volpar, the twin turbine beach, sitting there. And I looked at that for a couple of minutes, thinking, boy, it would be nice if we could just jump into that thing and I could fly to Bangkok or Hong Kong or something like that and just avoid shipboard life.
Mm-hmm.
And finally decided that, sure as shooting I do that, and there's going to be something wrong with it. And then I'm not going to, something's going to happen to the helicopter, and we're going to be stuck here. And
mm-hmm.
Now, bird in the hand is better than the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So, as it turned out, it apparently wasn't anything wrong with it. It was full of fuel, and because the pilot who was supposed to be flying it, he bugged out with his newfound family, and he was on his way to the Guam.
Mm-hmm. As a capstone to this, I have twin questions. What was the most important thing you took away personally from your experience in Southeast Asia, flying in Laos and supporting the missions? And then, secondly, what do you think is the most important lesson that we should take away from the experience in Southeast Asia as a nation, you know, historically?
Well, I'd say I developed a love for the people and that part of the world. That was the biggest thing I came out with. Unquestionably, you know, we've got to get the politicians out of the decision-making process in the future. And I mean, if we're going to fight a war, then we need to fight it like it is a war and fight it to win. Because it was so depressing to look back and see that we lost it. You know, they didn't necessarily win it.
Mm-hmm.
And all friends that I had that were killed over there, it was all for nothing. That was probably the biggest disappointment for me and the most depressing part of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like you were just being pawns. And that we were not important in the grand scheme of things, you know. We were just somebody pulling strings and playing games. And it was just not the commitment. We had the commitment. I mean, I think the Air America folks are probably the most dedicated people over there. Simply because we didn't have to be there. Nobody forced us. We could leave any time we wanted. And yet we were there because I think for the most part, we loved the people. And particularly the Mayo, the Hmong, these folks, they didn't have any particular allegiance to the government or anything like that. All they cared about was raising their family and growing their crops and being left alone. They were willing to fight for that. And we were supporting them, but not well enough.
Anything else you like that?
That's probably we're there for now.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. This ends the first interview with Mr. Burke. This is Steve Maxter continuing the interview with Mr. Marius Burke on April 12, 2001 at 8:30 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Burke is in Melbourne, Florida. Sir, I wanted to begin today's session by discussing your time as a chief pilot in Udorn. And although we have discussed this in the previous interview, I just wanted to flesh that out, go into a little more detail. Would you state again exactly the primary responsibilities for you as the chief pilot?
Well, primarily, I started out as assistant chief pilot to Wayne Knight, and that was, I think probably in 64, 65 probably. I don't remember the exact dates. And then eventually moved into the chief pilot spot. We essentially were responsible for coordinating with the customers, for all the scheduling. We did the flight training and maintenance flying, and pretty much ran the basic operation.
And in addition to checking out pilots and doing other things, did you also go on support missions for personnel in Laos?
Oh, sure. And see, a lot of our training and check rides, other than the proficiency check rides that we would do right there at Udorn, the rest of it, what we call route checks and initial checkouts for pilots, we're done up country. And we would go up anywhere from one day to a week and fly with the individual on the line for, you know, whatever missions were going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we got short on pilots or things like that, we go up there just to fly missions ourselves.
And what aircraft did this include in terms of the work that you did?
Well, let's see. I flew the H-34, the S-58T, the CH-47, Chinook. Got involved with a Bell 47 training program. We were training Thai pilots. Helped out with some training of Lao pilots, and we had to use 500s, UH-1Hs, the 204Bs, the 205s. These are all Bells. I think that pretty much covered all the helicopters that.
I was just going to say, that sounds like the inventory of helicopters.
Yeah, pretty much. The neat part about me was that I got a chance to check out on all of them. And typical company policy was no more than two types of aircraft for checkouts for pilots. Mm-hmm. So that was a fun part of the job that I got to fly any and all of these things.
Now, not just the restriction in terms of the number of aircraft within a specific type, that is, fixed wing versus rotary wing. So typically company policy was only two, say, rotary wing aircraft. Was there much crossing over from fixed wing to rotary wing for pilots?
No. It was the same thing on the fixed wing side. I don't think there were very many people that flew more than, you know, one or two types of airplanes or helicopters at any point in time. Mm-hmm. Now, I also, I think I mentioned that it flown the T-28s too, so that was an unusual type thing. We didn't have anybody that, I'm the only one that I'm aware of, that flew both airplanes and helicopters at the same time. Now, we had a number of helicopter people, well, not a large number, but a small number, that transferred to fixed wing. Prior primarily they would go with maybe take a co-pilot's position or something like that, and hopefully eventually upgrade to captain, depending on what their background and experience was. And that was primarily for folks who did have some airplane background before. And there was, well, there was one or two folks that transferred over from airplanes into helicopters. But again, these were people who had a lot of helicopter experience previously.
Okay. And when they transferred over, they wouldn't just jump back and forth between aircraft. They would,
no.
They would be assigned.
No, no. Once, if you were in the airplane side of it, you just flew airplanes, and if you were in the helicopter side, you just flew helicopters.
Okay. Now, you mentioned just a moment ago allow pilot training program. What would you go ahead and describe that and what it entailed and what the purpose for that program was?
Well, this was a program that was started, I guess in the late, mid-60s. And it was handled by, initially, they had two Marine pilots came over, and they had, I don't know, three or four LAO students, and they were, it was like a year program. They used H-34s, which Air America provided. We did all the maintenance and everything else for them, and they conducted their training. And then the LAO pilots, they would be flying for the LAO Air Force in H-34s. And it started out the first year, there was two Marines, and then the second year, there was one Marine, a fellow by the name of Paul Walton, who at that time was, he was active duty with the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had gone through flight training together, and so we worked very closely together. And I helped him at times in the training aspect. And he had three pilots, all of whom had had some previous flight experience, primarily with either the French or the Russians over the years. And he ran them through a one-year program. And then I believe when Paul left, they sent an Army pilot over to take over that program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And would LAO pilots fly in like a joint operation capacity with Air America? Or was this just for LAO Royal Air activity?
Yeah, this was just primarily for Royal Air LAO
operations. Okay. And I was also curious about the role that either you played personally or Air America pilots play generally in both medevac and SAR missions while you were in Udorn.
In what respect?
Well, I was curious if this was if it was commonplace for both types of operations. There's of course some interest in the part of the association, but also historically, I think it's important to understand what role Air America played, given the number of aircraft they had flying throughout, especially Laos, and I would imagine that many of them were stationed out of Udorn, flying missions into Laos. But of course, with American overflights of North Vietnam, a lot of pilots ditching into Laos. I was just curious, from your perspective, what you witnessed in terms of either medevac missions for those or SAR missions for those types of pilots or for other individuals.
Well, for the most part, in the early years, Air America was the only search and rescue capability over there.
Mm-hmm.
The military didn't have any aircraft-based, obviously, in Laos or Thailand, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we essentially ran all the missions that encountered, military pilots being shot down or what have you. And, of course, we did all the medevacs of and the ties and so forth who were fighting up there. That was, unfortunately, a big part of our mission was to evacuate those folks. Mm-hmm. And for many years, we were not officially allowed to have weapons or anything else like that. And for many years, we had no armor plating or anything like that in the aircraft. We flew single pilot. It was a pretty challenging scenario. Mm-hmm. Later on, the Air Force finally came in with some Jolly Greens, primarily based out of Udorn. Mm-hmm. And they were there ostensibly to do search and rescue for military pilots who would go down in Laos and, and possibly up there in Vietnam also. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had been doing both for quite some time. And even while the Air Force was there, we probably still picked up, I would say, probably the majority of the folks who went down. Mm-hmm. And the main reason being, we were flying up there. Yes, and typically, if you could get in within the first 30 minutes of somebody going down, you had a good chance of getting them out. After that, it became rather problematical. Mm-hmm. And so in many cases, somebody would get shot down, and next thing you know, Air America helicopter is in there, pulls the pilot out, or pilots, mm-hmm. and as they're coming out, here we become the Jolly Greens, saying, well, we're on our way, and say, well, we've already got the guys. And so they'd rendezvous with them at some safe area and exchange, and the Air Force would bring them back to Thailand. Mm-hmm. Towards the end, they started basing up country, I think, just during the day, particularly if there were, missions that were going on and so forth, so they were a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. But again, the big problem was... they didn't know the country very well, and once their tour of duty was up, they'd rotate out, and a new group would be there, where with Air America, we were pretty much there for the duration, and we just had a far better feel for the situation and the intelligence and just the ability to be in close proximity when something happened. It was obviously a big advantage.
Yes, sir. Well, regarding intelligence, so much, I would imagine, so much of a successful SAR mission rides on being able to arrive not just to the correct point, but to the correct point while evading enemy forces that might be in your path. Air America, of course, had an intimate knowledge of enemy forces typically in a particular area, and so as pilots you could avoid contact. Would there be cross-briefings to Air Force SAR pilots so that they could share that information, or was that just that didn't happen?
Well, there wasn't much, unfortunately. That was a big disappointment to me, because I felt that we in our group had the best information, because we were spread out all over the country. Mm-hmm. And every time our pilots would come back, they'd debrief Flight Information Center folks and say, oh yeah, well, this hilltop over here, they got a machine gun now, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was all, up-to-date information. The Air Force didn't have as much hands-on information like that. And they were invited to come over and meet with our FIC folks. And there were some that did, but for the most part, there was just, there was a strange attitude that a lot of folks didn't know what we were doing. They didn't necessarily trust us. Mm-hmm. And they would kind of say, geez, we got the best intelligence information going. Why, we need to talk to those folks. Mm-hmm.
Well, the mistrust that existed, excuse me, between Air America and the Air Force, and really Air America, of course, has been shrouded in secrecy and myth during the war and really since the war. One of those myths involves the idea that Air America pilots were compensated in special ways for certain activities, to include SAR rescues. Did that ever happen to your knowledge?
We did not get special pay for SAR missions. Essentially, the only thing we got was, we got hazardous duty pay for flying in what was considered denied areas,
mm-hmm.
where it's enemy areas. And, I'm trying to remember, I think it was like, $5 an hour or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly in the early days, when we were essentially the only SAR capability, the only way we really made any extra money was by flying.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you flew and you're in denied areas and things like that, you get your flight pay and your hazardous duty pay. And initially, if they had scheduled reconnaissance flights or what have you coming over, we'd get a call. I remember a number of occasions when I was working away up in northern Laos, and I'd be single pilot, single aircraft, probably another aircraft within 100 miles, and they'd say, you need to go ahead and shut down by the radio station and stand by. They're going to be running missions for the next day or so, and if somebody gets shot down, it's up to you to go in and get them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we sat on the ground, we didn't fly, we didn't make any money. And if somebody did get shot down, it was interesting that they never got shot down in friendly areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a pleasant scenario to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would get our, our standard hazardous duty pay and so forth for it.
Right.
And that was probably one of the biggest difficulties we had, I guess, relationship-wise with the military, because their sense was that, we were getting big bucks for every pilot we picked up over there. And I think that created some animosity, that the only reason we were picking them up was because we were making big bucks for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, that would have been nice, but I think almost to a man, every one of us realized that, that could be us down there.
Yes, sir.
And that's one of our people, and if we can get them out of there, we need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a question of, how much money am I going to be paid, because they couldn't have paid us enough money to do that. Just for that basis.
Yes, sir. And certainly the nature of the mission is you go in as quickly as possible, grab whoever's down, and get out as quickly as possible. So in terms of hazardous duty pay, you're not looking at a whole lot of time in a hostile area because you're trying to get out of there.
Oh, sure. Maybe you made $5.
Right.
So,
you're not going to make a whole lot at $5 an hour.
Yeah.
Also, I'm curious, did you encounter this personally while you were in country, this notion based on other military pilots you talked with, that Air America pilots were getting compensated bonuses or whatever in special ways for picking up?
Oh, yeah, we hear these stories all the time.
Mm-hmm.
$15,000, $20,000 a pickup.
Wow.
One curious national, one of the good friend of mine, Bob Nunes, had been in the Air Force, and he'd flown with the Jolly Greens.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew, I think it was really the first crew of Jolly Greens that came over to UDART.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they talked to him about, all this money that we were making for picking people up. And Bobby says, look, that's not the case. And he spent a long time convincing him, what the real story was, and he pretty well convince them that that was what it was. And unfortunately, oh, and this fellow's name escapes me now, but he was a new pilot, been around helicopters for many years, but turns out, I guess he was an alcoholic. Anyways, he had been maybe in Udon just for a week or two when he was still undergoing, you know, local training. And this one day, he was around the traffic pattern, and they needed to send an aircraft down to Savannakhet to drop off some parts. So we sent him down with the pilot, and so they flew down to Savannakhet, dropped the parts off, and came back to Udarn, you know, strictly a milk run. And that evening, he happened to be staying at the same hotel downtown as the Air Force Jolly Green guys, and I guess he was pretty well out of it. And he was standing in the hallway, and these folks came by, and they saw, I think he had his Air America uniform on, and they struck up a conversation, and they says, well, geez, how are things going? He says, oh, really had a good day today. We had to go out on a mission and pick up some pilots that got shot down, and boy, we got the shit shot out of us and so forth. And they said, really? Wow. He says, yeah, but not bad, you know, 15 grand. Oh, these guys were just outraged. And they went and got a hold of Bobby and said, boy, what a lion sack you are. And Bobby says, wow. Oh, he came and passed the word on the base, talked to old Clarence Abbey, and this fellow was on the next train out of town. I mean, that probably set us back quite a ways.
Wow.
And, you know, whatever possessed them to come up with that story was hard to understand.
Yes, sir. Well, another interesting component to this is, to your understanding, if you were to give an approximate percentage, how many Air America pilots were former military pilots?
Oh, probably 98%, particularly on the helicopter side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we had any helicopter pilots who were not formerly in the military flying.
Yes, sir.
And so, primarily on the helicopter side, you know, it's pretty tough for anybody to get helicopter license and the training and the experience without having been in the military.
Yes, sir.
We had a few, you know, a few more folks on the fixed-wing side that probably had not been in the military, but very few.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in addition to the issue you discussed previously, that is, as most Air America pilots saw it, when you heard of a downed pilot, the thought, immediate thought, was that could be me. And certainly there's a military bond there as well.
Sure. Exactly.
And I was curious about the spontaneity of these operations. I was under the impression that most of the Air America SAR operations would basically occur on the cuff. You know, you be flying a mission, you hear of a downed pilot, you drop what you're doing, you go get him.
That's pretty much the way it worked. I mean, there were some times, as I mentioned, where they had scheduled missions, and particularly in the early years, and they were, you know, they were real paranoid, real concerned about, you know, when these guys got shot down, you know, about how they were going to get them out. And so in those cases, when they knew they had, say, 1 or 2 days worth of, you know, heavy reconnaissance flights or what have you, that's when they would just, you know, stand us down. So we would be immediately available to go. And it wouldn't be all the aircraft. It would be whatever aircraft happened to be in the area that they were running these missions.
Yes, sir.
So they didn't want us to be, you know, 50, 60 miles away in the middle of another mission when something like that happened.
Okay. So you'd be on standby in the event that the pilot was shot down.
Right.
Okay. Now, do you recall, was there a consistent schedule where there would be Air America pilots on standby in case there were? No.
No, it was just you'd be up country and you'd get a call and say, go over to the radio station and shut down, and we'll give you instructions.
Okay. Now, was Bobby Nunez an Air America pilot as well? You mentioned he flew Jolly Greens.
Well, he had been in the Air Force before he came with Air America.
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha. Good enough. Let's see. And, again, you mentioned that a lot of the medevac missions, and, of course, a consistent component of your operations, included going into Laos and pulling out Thai and Lao forces. Was that something you personally engaged in a significant amount of time? Or?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Essentially everybody.
Okay.
Did.
Did you work in a particular area of Laos in that respect? Or all over the country?
No, pretty much all over the country, from one end to the other. And we tried to schedule people, in different areas for a couple of reasons. One, that, they became familiar with all the areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that, some areas are probably maybe a little more or less desirable to fly in than others, whether it be the flying or the living conditions or what have you. So you didn't want to stick one person or a few people in just one specific area.
Okay. And I was wondering if you were cognizant of, and if you participated in knowingly, the South Vietnamese offensive, Lam Son 719, and if you knew if Air America provided any kind of support for that particular operation.
I can't say specifically if we were or in what manner of support we would have provided.
Okay.
I really can't say for sure.
Okay.
The folks there in, flying out of Saigon may possibly have had some involvement, and we may have had some helicopters somewhat involved, but it probably would have been peripherally, not in direct support.
Okay. Do you know if any Lao forces under American leadership were involved? That is, of course, run by the customers on the ground.
Oh, I would suspect so, but again, I don't really have any direct knowledge.
Okay. Good enough. All right, so this will end the interview with Marius Burke on April 12th. Thank you very much, sir. And this is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Marius Burke on the 17th of April, 2001, at approximately 8:15 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Burke is in Melbourne, Florida. Sir, why don't you go ahead and discuss some of the hazards you face as a pilot flying over Laos, and in particular, enemy hazards and also natural hazards.
Well, you had the combination of enemy activity and weather, and the weather being the rainy season, and you had low-lying clouds, heavy rain, and the like. And in the smoky season, you had very thick smoke that was literally like flying IFR. You could see maybe an eighth of a mile in front of you, and maybe you could see straight down, and that'd be about it. That was challenging enough to go along with the very rugged terrain that you were flying over, with many mountains and so forth. But then you had to contend with the enemy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Laos was, from my understanding, had more anti-aircraft weapons than they had in Germany in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty exciting to be flying along with no real capabilities to do much. And you'd see these orange basketballs come flying by in the sky, and you knew they were gunning for you. And naturally, in the helicopters particularly, you were generally at lower altitudes. So, you know, small arms fire was obviously always a threat.
Mm-hmm. What kind of armor did you guys have for personal protection in the helicopters you flew?
Well, in the early days, we didn't have anything. But then eventually, they ended up installing some armor plating that would fit in the bottom of the seat in the back. Mm-hmm. And then they had, at least on the H-34s and S-58Ts, sliding panels on the side windows in the cockpit. And that was really the extent of the armor plating. And we would bring, the guys would bring maybe black vests with them or something like that, mostly to sit on. And, you know, it obviously, I'm sure, saved a lot of people. But there was, we lost a number of people through sniper fire, as near as we could determine. The other side would position these folks with long rifles and scopes, I assume, on mountaintops or on cuts where aircraft would be trying to sneak through and so forth. And their only mission was to, I guess, get the pilot. Mm-hmm. And we had a number of pilots who were killed with just one single round in the head.
My goodness.
And that's when we pretty much went to two pilots in the cockpit. Prior to that time, it was primarily just flew with one pilot. Probably the most exciting scenario for me, it was ironically, it was I think the last day flying up in Laos, and essentially they had the ceasefire accords were in effect, and it was just a question of moving people around and removing equipment and supplies and all that sort of stuff. And, I had been flying an S-58T, and we were just flying single pilot at that point, and we'd taken out the armor plating as a weight-saving device so we could carry a greater load, since there was supposedly no concern about being fired upon. And I had made this shuttle probably 30 or 40 times that day, back and forth over the same ridgeline, going out of 20 alternate and carrying supplies and people back. And it was actually, it was going to be my last trip, and I was coming back, and I'd flown over the same ridgeline, like I say, probably 30 or 40 times. And it was just getting, you know, it was late in the afternoon. It was just, it wasn't dark yet, but it was getting that way. And this was a sort of a typical scenario for the other side too. They like to do things late in the afternoon because that made it real difficult to launch search and rescue efforts and things like that. Pretty tough to do at night. So, anyways, I'm coming over this ridgeline, and suddenly the left window, co-pilot's window, just shattered. And I just instinctively, you know, made a very steep turn in the opposite direction. And it was quiet for like 4 or 5 seconds until I righted the aircraft, and apparently they realized that I was still in a flying mode. And then the entire hillside, there must have been 1,500 of them down there, opened up. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I managed to get by them. But they'd just been sitting there biding their time and figured, okay, this is probably the last trip. See if we can handle this guy. And as it turned out, in fact, I still have it. I've got it framed in my office here. The bullet that came through that window, when we took out the armor plating, there was about a one-inch rail that kind of held the armor plating in place that was attached to the base of the window, and that was still there. And the bullet hit, probably just below the top edge of that rail. And it was lined up right for my head.
Wow.
And it hit that rail and just sort of tumbled and actually landed in my lap. And, I'm sure they were real disappointed, but they obviously had me boresighted.
Yes, sir.
And so those were the types of things that, you kind of expected them to happen, but it was always a surprise when it did.
Especially that close, a
right.
miss. did you know other pilots that had similar near misses like that?
Oh, I'm sure every pilot had, near misses. There were plenty of them where, everybody got shot up at one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But that one was probably as close as you could get without getting injured.
Yes, sir. Now, what do you think was the largest anti-aircraft weapon used against you when you were flying in Laos?
Oh, probably the 37 millimeter.
Okay.
Although, I think the Volpar that Jim Ryan was in that got hit, I believe they said it was an 85.
Okay. And that's when Jim Ryan lost his leg.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Now, where were you when that happened? Were you in the vicinity, or?
No, I don't remember exactly where I was, whether I was up country or even out of the country. Because I don't believe I was in Udorn when they came back. Otherwise, I would have probably been there to meet them when they got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned before we started recording this morning an incident occurred. Near the PEJ, where you had to gain significant altitude and kind of fly over that. I was wondering if you'd go ahead and talk about that.
Okay, one of the problems we had, obviously, was battling the weather and at the same time staying clear of enemy areas. And I'll have to say that Air America and our flight information folks probably had some of the best intelligence going up there, and for a couple of reasons. One being our folks were there sort of for the duration. You became very familiar with the area, and word got passed very quickly if something changed. And, of course, whenever the pilots would come home, they'd have to go into FIC and they'd debrief and say, well, this hillside over here, they've got enemy activity and they've got weapons over here and so forth. And so that was never a guarantee in a fluid situation, obviously, but pretty much you kind of knew where you could go. And as long as you knew where you were, and you didn't have the weather restricting you, you could probably safely make your way around. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were a lot of places that we went that were either no man's land or they were known enemy in the area, and you just simply had to fly over them. And for the most part, we would go as high as we could practically fly over those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the weather didn't always cooperate. And the plane, the jars, for probably 90% of the time we were over there, was typically under control of the communists. And ironically, it always seemed like the plane, the jars, would be relatively clear weather-wise. And the weather seemed to ring around the planes.
Mm.
And so that was always a challenge. And if we were working way up north of the Plain de Jars, I mean, we would have to go all the way around the Horn, take, you know, the long way up and the long way back. And
mm-hmm.
fuel was always a consideration, obviously. And one day I was coming back after flying all day, and it was just a long line of thunderstorms all around the planes, and there was no way I was going to get around them, and couldn't really get through them.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of moved in behind me also, so I couldn't go back to where I'd been,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't a particularly secure area anyways. And so I just climbed up to about 20,000 feet, and flew directly over the planes.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, there was a high cloud cover. Made it across, and I didn't think too much of it at the time, but looking back on it, having a little more experience, I was probably up there 15 to 20 minutes at that altitude with no oxygen, which
mm-hmm.
isn't always the greatest scenario.
Yes, sir.
But it worked, and
do you remember becoming lightheaded at all?
No, I didn't. I had my flight mechanic and myself on board. It was
mm-hmm.
a Bell 204B, I believe. And it was, you get up at that altitude and the helicopter is not real responsive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it tends to, like you're flying on ahead of a needle. Type of thing, yeah.
Interesting. Is it because the higher you, the more altitude you gain, the less lift that you have?
Or? Well, that, but, the air is so so thin
mm-hmm.
That you don't have as much stability.
Okay.
And I don't doubt that probably the lack of oxygen didn't help that matter either.
Yeah. Sir. Did the enemy that was occupying the PDJ at that point, they didn't have anything that could reach you that high?
Oh, they did, but I suspect they either didn't recognize I was up there, and I think the cloud cover
mm-hmm.
Was certainly a help. It didn't help Jim Ryan, because they were above a solid overcast when they got hit.
Oh, okay.
But they had, you know, radar-controlled 37 millimeters, but hard to say how well they were equipped,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how accurate, and whether, you know, they would even turn them on
right.
unless they were looking for something.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was curious, when you mentioned earlier the sniper activity that, you know, the enemy would engage in to actually try to take out the pilots of these helicopters, of your helicopters. When that first started happening, was there any change in your procedures or your operating procedures in terms of not flying straight line, you know, zigzagging, stuff like that?
No, not really, because that really wouldn't make any difference. I mean, we're going slow enough that
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't be a problem. But,
okay.
The biggest change we made was we ended up going to two crews
mm-hmm.
on board the aircraft
okay.
because we lost a couple where, you know, they were just one pilot. And we lost some helios, but I think in a couple of the high lattices, you know, they would fly a lot of times at low altitudes and mm-hmm. sneaking over ridge lines and things like that.
Yes, sir. So the slow-moving single-engine aircraft were susceptible to the same types of hazards
sure.
that you were.
Sure.
Okay.
And whether it would necessarily be a sniper or just, you know, lucky shots from folks on the ground, I mean, when you're down at low altitude, you're certainly a much easier target.
Yes, sir. Okay. And was there anything else that you wanted to discuss with regard to your time flying in Laos?
That's a...
I know, it's a big question.
Yeah, that's an awful open-ended one there.
I know. Is there anything you can think of, though?
No, other than the fact that it was just, it was very challenging.
Yes, sir.
Type of flying. And it took a particular type of individual to, you know, survive over there, too. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of luck involved, too.
Now, as the chief pilot, you were responsible for checking out pilots, correct?
Right.
Did you have difficulties at all with, as you mentioned, flying in this type of environment is very dependent on personality and skill and luck. Were there any difficulties you encountered in that context?
Oh, not so much. We had a good training program. We had a good staff of instructor pilots. And mm-hmm. typically on the helicopter side, you know, the pilots would undergo local flight training,
mm-hmm.
just learning the systems and the aircraft and the way we operated it and so forth. And then they would go up country with another pilot or, oh, maybe 1 to 3 months. And at such point in time as it was felt that they were ready for upgrade to captain,
mm-hmm.
then either myself, Wayne Knight, Bill Hutchison, and our other staff pilots would, instructor pilots would go up and give them their final checkout.
Mm-hmm.
And that typically would be from maybe 4 days to a week of just essentially flying the line.
Mm-hmm.
To ensure that, you know, they were able to do all the different things that they needed to be able to do and knew the area. Familiarity with the area was the biggest challenge, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the weather was bad, all those mountains looked the same.
Yes, sir. In terms of your job, was it made easier by the fact that Air America hired a significant number of former military pilots? And so they had basically experienced a lot of the hazards of flying over a country during war.
Well, yes. Particularly as time went by, essentially all of the pilots who came to work for us had flown in the military and... The vast majority, particularly in later years, I think had all been over there in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, you know, that experience for sure. So they were generally pretty well qualified,
mm-hmm.
and typically they were, you know, qualified in the aircraft that they'd be flying with us.
Mm-hmm. Now, you left Udorn in 1974.
Right.
Before that, of course, some significant diplomatic political events had taken place regarding the United States efforts in Southeast Asia, in particular the complete withdrawal of U.S. Ground forces after the Paris Peace Accords of 1973. I was wondering, what were the biggest changes you witnessed in Laos, flying over Laos, after the Peace Accords were signed?
There really wasn't any great changes other than, you know, right at the end, there was pretty much everybody was supposed to be staying in place wherever they happened to be, and they weren't supposed to be shooting at you and so forth. We didn't really trust that, obviously, and we didn't go flying over enemy territory to test it out.
Mm-hmm.
But there just wasn't, you know, the type of activity that was going on before in terms of, you know, moving troops around or attacks and things like that.
Okay. So your op-tempo did decrease?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. And there was just a gradual crank down. You know, we started cutting back on our pilots, and we were trying to encourage people to take their home leave or transfer down to Saigon or what have you, wherever we could place them, because there simply wasn't enough flying to justify all the people that we had.
Yes, sir. And while you were flying over Laos, from the time you got there to the time you left, did you, in terms of the briefings you received and things like that, was there a noticeable increase over time in terms of North Vietnamese activity? And you know, did it start at a smaller tempo and then increase over time? Did it stay static and pretty much the same? You know, what was your experience that you recall?
Oh, sure. It built to a crescendo, actually, towards the end. And in the early days, well, it was hard to tell because there wasn't a lot of activity. We didn't have a lot of aircraft, didn't have a lot of people, and we weren't doing very much. When I first got there in 63, I think the average pilot flew maybe 10 hours a month. That was it. You know, 4 or 5 years later, I went for a period where I averaged close to 200 hours a month.
Wow.
And so, vast difference in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you would see the activity on the road, Ho Chi Minh Trail, and all of that. And, so there was, I would suspect, not a lot of North Vietnamese there in the early days. But as time went by, I think they pretty much were running the show.
Mm-hmm. Would you, and you said that was about 4 years into your experience, that your operational tempo increased to a peak, about 67 or so?
Well, I wouldn't say a peak.
Oh, okay.
It built up significantly. Probably the nastiest time was around the 70, 71, 72 time frame.
Okay.
Because I took some leave and went back to the college there in California for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was getting ready to work on my thesis, company was anxious for me to come back because things had really picked up. And so I went back for, I think a quarter for 3 months or something like that while I was working on my thesis, and flew and then went back to school for another semester.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed a remarkable difference in the level of activity and in the hazardous nature and so forth. There was a lot of new case officers that operated differently than the old folks like Tony Poe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think were probably a lot more reckless. And there was, it tended to be towards the end some real hard feelings on a lot of people's parts, both from the customer standpoint and from the pilot standpoint, where the customers wanted the pilots to do certain things, and the pilots were not necessarily wanting to do these things because they felt it was just too hazardous, mm-hmm. and there wasn't enough support being provided. And so it got to be some pretty hard feelings.
Wow.
And that was really unfortunate. I remember the Thais had an artillery group there on Site 15, which was only like 5-10 minutes from the 20 alternate. Mm-hmm. And it was on an airstrip, and it was in a bowl surrounded by mountains. And they were essentially surrounded. And they would have us go in, sometimes 2, 3, 4 times a day with anywhere from, 2 to 6 or 8 helicopters, mm-hmm. Bring in supplies, bringing people out, carrying out wounded, carrying out bodies, and so forth. It was like running the gauntlet, because wherever you would come in, almost immediately after that, there would be mortars coming into that same spot. You would see enemy soldiers probably within a couple hundred feet just standing up and shooting at you. And we got to the point where we literally couldn't land. We were pulling bodies out in cargo nets and dropping things off in cargo nets. And we had, we had air cover and everything else, which was the only thing that probably even allowed us to do that. And it was, I remember saying to myself, wow, this is really nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the trips in there were really kind of unnecessary, where the case officer would decide, well, I've got to go in there and talk to these folks on the ground. And I says, can't you just do it on the radio or what have you?
Mm-hmm.
And he could have.
Mm-hmm.
But, he was gung-ho, I guess, but he was putting a lot of people at risk in the process, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And pilots were, getting a little tired of this. And the amazing thing, actually, was we didn't lose anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for, probably at least a month. And finally, one night, I think there were like 1,200 Thais. They just left. In the middle of the night, they walked out, and pretty much unmolested. I think they probably made a deal
wow.
with the other side, and they walked out. And of course, the word was out that, if Air America had provided adequate support, that wouldn't have happened. And that was really kind of a slap in the face, because I think, the guys flying up there and going into that place were doing everything they could humanly possibly do and then some, and should have been amply recognized in a positive way for,
mm-hmm.
for what they did, rather than be put down by at least some people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying everybody did that, but... And so there tended to be, things got real dicey.
Yes, sir.
There were a lot of places where they would have missions, or they'd have outposts that were under attack and needed to be evacuated or what have you. And, it was heavy enemy concentrations, and anti-aircraft weapons and so forth to contend with. And we had to come up with a policy that, if we're going to go into situations like this, we've got to have cover.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have cover, we're just not going to send the helicopters in there under those conditions.
Yes, sir.
Because it's, doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, they were never always able to get cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of times when they'd try to downplay the the gravity of the situation and say, oh, yeah, it's not a problem over there. You know, you can go in and to get the pilots to go without the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they would go, but a lot of times they'd say, wait a minute. We know what the situation is over there, and that's just suicide to try to go in there without any kind of backup and cover. And customers were, you know, they would get upset. And I remember there were times when, you know, I'd get a call and you got to come up here. You know, your pilots aren't doing the job they're supposed to be doing. And I think without fail, I'd listen to the brief and I come to the same conclusion that, we're not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there tended to be a little bit of animosity that came out of that with some of the customers and some of the pilots,
mm-hmm.
which was really unfortunate. And I could see it from the customer standpoint. I mean, they had their people out there that were in trouble, and they wanted to get them out.
Yes, sir.
But sometimes folks lost sight of reality. And, you know, it's one thing to have some people in trouble, and you send more people out there to get into more trouble and lose more people. You know, it just doesn't compute.
Yes, sir. Well, certainly that story brings into stark relief the various conflicting issues that you all had to cope with and had to work with, in that you're civilian pilots, you're not armed, you don't have direct, immediate internal fire support, because you're civilians. At the same time, you're trying to accommodate and work with within a war and make a profit. So you can't lose pilots and aircraft, because that's going to cut into your margin there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, the mere fact that you did succeed as much as you did is amazing in those light of those circumstances.
Well, I know Bill Lehrer, I think, made the comment many times that we accomplished more with a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Doing what we did in Laos than the military ever did over there in Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, unfortunately, in the grand scheme of things, in the end, it still came to naught.
But still, it's quite an accomplishment. What time period with the Thai artillery unit that you were providing that support? What time period was that? Was that during that high tempo period when you went back, or?
Yeah, this was. Well, it was probably just before I left and after I came back, and really pretty much till the end, the Thais were over there and, in fairly good numbers, mostly artillery groups and things like that.
Okay. But that particular point where the Thais left and walked out, was that before or after you finished your schooling, your university training?
Oh, that was in the middle. That's when
I came
over there for a 3-month hitch.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just walking out of that particular post.
Right. Was that, do you know if that was during the Easter Offensive in Vietnam? When the North Vietnamese tried they did attack into South Vietnam? And during Easter of 72?
No, that would have been in 70, I think.
Okay.
Was the time frame. I look back at a lot of these dates, and it's hard to place them exactly. And the only reason I can place that one fairly well is the fact that it was in between my school when I was there at school between 69 and 71. So.
Okay. Do you remember the Easter Offensive of 72? And did you guys hear about that activity and support actions against the North Vietnamese coming in from Laos?
Oh, I think peripherally you know, all that stuff seemed to be the same. Mm-hmm. Actually, there was always something going on. Other than, you know, what we got through our intelligence information on activity and so forth, news information over there was relatively limited. Mm-hmm. Most of what you'd get would be Time or Newsweek magazine, which was usually so far off the mark that you knew that 90% of what you're reading was baloney anyways. It was mm-hmm. probably made up by some journalist who sat there in the Continental Hotel lounge there in Vincennes and would glean information from bios that had too much to drink or something.
Okay.
And took that as gospel to what was going on.
Were there any inaccuracies or errors in reporting that stand out in your mind still today? Or is it just in general bad reporting?
Just in general. You'd read stuff in the magazines, you'd look at that and say, well, geez, I don't remember that.
Okay.
Where'd that come from? That's a bunch of baloney.
Okay.
Yeah, it was essentially that. And, of course, the big part of it was the fact that, you know, they weren't allowing these folks to go up country.
Mm-hmm.
So their only source of information was people that they could probably buttonhole and or overhear people talking or what have you, or just, I think it's mostly based on rumors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And was there any newspaper or magazine that, or perhaps radio program, that got it right? That you know, maybe not all the time, but was pretty close to reporting accurately what was occurring in Laos?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. Very interesting. Did that change at all when you went to Vietnam?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, this will end the interview with Mr. Marius Burke on April 17th. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Marius Burke on the 19th of April 2001 at approximately 8:10 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Burke is in Melbourne, Florida. Sir, why don't we go ahead and continue with our discussion of the transition from Thailand and flying over Laos to Saigon. What time period did that occur, and what was your primary, or not Saigon, but Vietnam, because you worked in Da Nang as well. But what was the purpose of that transition? What did you do there?
Oh, essentially, I was just going to go down there and fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already made plans to probably finish up my career there in June of 75, since I had interest in the states that were calling me to come back urgently. And since we're leaving Thailand, I moved my family back to the States at that point in time. That, and in view of the fact that things were kind of up in the air in Vietnam anyways. But I felt sort of an obligation to hang around a little bit longer. So I packed my family up and shipped them to Utah, and I went down to Saigon and started flying there,
mm-hmm.
essentially all over the country.
Okay. Now, what was, at that point in time, this is 1974, so the peace accords have already been passed, and the U.S. ground forces have been completely removed by this point. What was, when you were flying around in Vietnam at this point, are you still flying around customers? Or what is your primary responsibility in terms of flying?
Oh, yeah, certainly we were flying customers around, doing work for the various agencies, USAID and so forth. And then, of course, they had the ICCS contract, which was kind of a bizarre scenario, because here you had... initially it was the Canadians and the Indonesians, and then the Hungarians and the Poles, and they were supposed to be monitoring, I guess, ceasefires and all of that sort of stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after I got there, Canadians just gave up in disgust, and they left. And they were subsequently replaced by the Iranians. And we had specially marked airplanes and helicopters with distinctive markings and so forth that we used strictly for the purpose of carrying these people around. And we even had, I think, different epaulettes and maybe different hats or insignias when we were flying them. And essentially, the trips, though I didn't fly very many of them myself, the ones we took were, they were scheduled. And as to time frames, altitudes, routes, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And very often they would be back behind enemy lines. And it was rather a bizarre scenario, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And my impression was that it was more of an intelligence passing on that procedure for the Poles and the Hungarians than anything else. They always had these big black suitcases that they carried with them. And I really didn't see where they were accomplishing anything constructive for our side at all.
When you mentioned the Hungarians and the Poles passed or carrying these suitcases, would they, when they get back on, would they still have them, or were they left behind?
Typically they would carry them in and carry them out.
Okay. So
obviously they had stuff inside that they were doing something with.
Yes. And you said the Canadians left in disgust. Did you get a chance to talk to any of them and get their perspective on what they were witnessing and why they were so disgusted?
I really didn't. This was very shortly after I arrived on the scene, and I didn't really know any of them. And, it was almost within probably weeks of my arrival that next thing I knew they were gone.
Hmm. Did you find out from anybody else, or did you talk with anybody else about this issue and find out other particulars about it? Or
Really didn't get any specific info on it, other than I think just their general feeling that it was a farce, and it was a waste of their time to be participating in it.
And the purpose for the meetings between the Canadians, Poles, Hungarians, and I assume the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, was to try to establish some kind of a peaceful negotiation? Or what?
Yeah, I assume that's that's what it was. But the whole thing seemed to be such a farce to me. It was hard to imagine just exactly, what, if anything, they were accomplishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really couldn't see where our side was, getting anything out of it.
Did you ever fly Americans to these meetings?
No.
Okay.
No. It was strictly those four groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm curious, when you were going into these areas, which were apparently enemy controlled, that is by either the PAVN or the what's left of the remnants of the Viet Cong, how were you greeted or treated when you would land and drop off these passengers?
Well, my only experience was one trip where we went back in the jungle and we landed, and these fellows in their pith helmets came out and they showed stood guard around our aircraft, and we just sat there and waited until the group came back and then took off and left.
Hmm.
So it was, oh, rather innocuous, though it was kind of a funny feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I probably have less of a feel for that than maybe a lot of the other pilots who were there, you know, prior to my getting over there.
Yes, sir.
And flew a lot more of those flights.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. When you were flying customers around at this point, what, or when you were flying in support of customers and CIA personnel, what were your principal missions in terms of, you know, were you just flying supplies out or just running people, you know, shuttling people to specific locations? Was there any fighting that you witnessed or anything like that?
No, it was mostly pretty basic stuff. For the most part, yeah, you might haul some supplies and things like that, but a lot of it was just hauling various customers around to the various sites that they wanted to visit and hold their meetings and so forth. And we carried a lot of Vietnamese folks in the same manner.
Mm-hmm. Did you get shot at while you were flying over Vietnam in 74, in early 75?
Yeah, but it wasn't... wasn't to the extent that we ran into things in, say, in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be a lot mellower, for the most part, anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And a lot of the places we would go were, you know, they were not particularly all that hazardous.
Mm-hmm. What did you think was going to happen? Or did you have any thoughts in terms of between North and South Vietnam?
Oh, I really didn't have a good feel for it one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I've started going through that other information that you sent me, and I've run up a copy of my notes on the evacuation, which would probably maybe clarify things a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
More in terms of perhaps observations and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until things started going downhill up there in Hue and Da Nang,
mm-hmm,
that I got the definite feeling that things were going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that just the panic and the fear shown by the South Vietnamese,
mm-hmm,
to me was pretty devastating in terms of their morale and leadership and so forth. And it didn't seem to be much of a will to, hey, we're going to stand and fight and protect our property. It was, I'm not going to get out of here.
This was in late 74, or what time period?
Oh, this would have been...
the Hue Da Nang.
Probably in... No, I might have to look at the dates, but probably in, say, around March 75.
Oh, okay. That much late, a little bit later then. Okay.
Yeah.
And when you say that, the tenor of the... or the... the feel you were getting from the Vietnamese, and that is primarily a fear, and how can I leave? Did you have many conversations with Vietnamese about what was happening? And I assume at that point there were quite a few English-speaking Vietnamese that you might be shuttling around.
Yeah, but there really wasn't much opportunity to sit down and talk with them.
Okay.
I mean, you'd have a mission, and they'd get on board, and you'd carry them where they wanted to go, and you'd drop them off, and
mm-hmm,
you'd come back and pick them up, and mm-hmm, what have you. So there really wasn't a lot of discussions at that point in time.
Okay.
And for the most part, I was somewhat turned off by the Vietnamese generals that I had occasion to carry around and have any conversation with. And they seem to be very aloof. Mm-hmm. They really weren't too interested in carrying on a conversation with a, you know, just an American
okay.
type thing. It was whether it was a status or these guys just really thought they were like God's gift to the military over there. And it was really disappointing. I remember one comment I had made. I forget his name now, but he was sort of the head general up there in Da Nang, that whole region. And when we were pulling people out on the last day, the consul general, I was taking him around doing things that he needed to be done, and he says, "Oh, I just got word that General so-and-so is literally going to kill himself." And he says, "I got to go save him." And I says, "Well, why?" I said, "He's really screwed up." And he was a real pompous mm-hmm. sort of guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's fine. You know, if he's sort of like a George Patton type, very tough and thinks well of himself and so forth, if he does the job and accomplishes it, good for him. You know, that's what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. But this guy apparently just, when things went bad, he just crumbled. And I said, "Hey, let him."
Did he go up and save him, though?
Well, I dropped him off, and I don't know, quite frankly, if he accomplished anything or if he actually got to see him or not.
Okay. But you didn't save and bring them both out?
No. In fact, we had to leave that evening, and Consul General said, "Well, his name is Francis, Al Francis." He says, "I'm not going out. I have to stay here." He says, "But come back and get me tomorrow." And I strongly advised him not to stay there overnight, but he was adamant. So that was the primary reason I went back the next day. Of course, we were also trying to track down some more of our local employees up there, one of which was my secretary, Sally,
mm-hmm.
and we were able to get them out.
Okay.
And we hunted all over for Francis the next day, and it wasn't until late that afternoon when we were just about out of fuel and having to leave, that we got word that he was on board a ship and wanted us to pick him up and fly him back. And, of course, we were unable to do that. We had a whole load of evacuees and mm-hmm. so forth. But as far as I was concerned, he was in safe hands, and we didn't need to extend ourselves beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what were you getting in terms of any kind of feedback or just, I don't know, the feelings, if you will, from the CIA personnel that you were shuttling around? You mentioned that, you know, the feeling that you were getting from some of the Vietnamese was that there was fear, concern, things like that. I was curious if the CIA case officers that were going into some of these areas, probably trying to hold things together at the last moment, if they were giving you any kind of feedback, either overtly or subliminally.
No, and that was actually a big disappointment. I was surprised at their lack of, I don't know, concern or awareness of what was really going on. I kind of outlined that in my report. They'd had reports of tanks ground north of Way,
mm-hmm.
and it was getting kind of tense up there. And we got a call to go up there and bring some people out. And as a result, I recommended to the customer that their people probably shouldn't be staying up there at night. You know, they wanted to go up there during the day, and we bring them back in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, no, we don't need to do that. And I think it was that very night we got a panic call to go up there and pull them out. So it was not a lot of information. And admittedly, I went up there to take over the operation as sort of like the base manager, to fill in for Frank Sturgard, who had been the base manager up there, and he was on home leave.
Okay.
And I'd only been up to Da Nang one previous time, I believe, maybe twice, for, you know, 4 or 5 days. And I didn't know, you know, really any of the people up there very well as a result. It was just, you know, I'd met them once or twice, perhaps. Some of them maybe hadn't met at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of feeling my way around. But it was really a big disappointment in the matter in which, well, to give you an example, the, I think the night that we brought the customers back from Way, no, it was one afternoon, we were then, after that, we brought them up in the morning, we brought them back in the evening. And one afternoon, one of them had left one of their special radios in the aircraft. And I thought to myself, maybe I'll just hang on to this. And it was somewhat fortuitous, I think, because it was some days later. And I had started staying at the base. And in fact, I'd encouraged all of our people to stay there at night rather than going downtown. Because my concern was if anything happened, we wouldn't be able to get back out to the base of the aircraft. And it was, I don't know, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly this radio came alive. And I heard voices, and one of them was saying, how many people do you have out there at the airport? Or how many Americans, I think it was. And this was sort of like the, oh, I guess he was the main base officer for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy Lewis was the air ops representative there at the field. And they were directly adjoining our compound at the field. There was probably about a 12-foot barbed wire fence between us, but the buildings were probably within 10 feet of each other. And Roy gave him a number, and I started counting in my mind, and I realized that didn't include us.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, get everybody and get on down to the docks right away. And that got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't sound real good. So I sat there for a few minutes expecting Roy to call me. And when he didn't, I called him. And I says, hey, is something going on? What's happening?
Mm-hmm.
And Roy said, well, I don't know, but we've been told to get our folks and go out to the docks. I said, oh, well, that's interesting. I said, well, what about us? And all I got was, well, do the best you can. And that was it.
Well, that's kind of ambiguous. Do you know what he meant?
Well, sure. I knew exactly what he meant.
Okay.
We were on our own. They were bugging out, and every man for himself.
Do you remember about what date this was?
I'd have to look through the paper, but I'll send that to you.
Okay, okay. But this must have been sometime in April, I would imagine. Well, we could just wait until we get the paper.
Yeah,
I was just curious.
It was either I lose track of these dates, but
right.
But let's see, maybe I can find it.
Did they get all their people out at that time?
Well, actually, we ended up having to go in and pull them out.
Oh, okay.
Because it turned out they couldn't get off the base.
Wow.
The Vietnamese wouldn't let them out. So, this was probably the end of March.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Looks like maybe it was the 27th of March or something like that.
Okay. So, very, yeah. This is almost within a month of Saigon falling.
Yeah, roughly.
Okay. Well, what was it like that last month? And what was your life like, and what did you and the other Air America pilots do for that last month?
Well, I was pretty busy. When I left Da Nang, went back to Saigon. I don't think I was in Saigon more than a day or so, and due to my experience, I guess, with the evacuation up in Da Nang, the company asked me to go up to Nha Trang and sort of oversee that operation. And I think I got up there about noon, and an evacuation was already underway when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I was back in Saigon, I guess, 9 o'clock that night. And the rest was almost kind of like a blur. By then, I was convinced that the end was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I got involved with plans for potential evacuation there in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
as well as, doing some flying missions around the area.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent a lot of time working with our flight information folks, folks at the embassy, and so forth. And that's when we came up with the plan to have these rooftop helipads.
Mm-hmm.
Because from my experiences there in Wei and Da Nang and Nha Trang, the biggest problem was being able to get the right people out without being mobbed.
Mm-hmm.
I remember vividly when we went back to our ramp there in Da Nang, trying to locate some of our workers, and there was one of our handyman that was running around on the ramp, and I mean, there was literally thousands of people there.
Wow.
And so here you are, you're trying to hover over him and convince this guy to reach up and pull him, snatch him out of the crowd. Well, everybody else wants to get up too, and,
mm-hmm.
and he kept, whenever he got close to him, he'd move away, because I guess the rotor wash and everything scared him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a totally unsatisfactory arrangement. So it was felt that if we could find some relatively secure buildings,
mm-hmm.
high rises,
mm-hmm.
that we could somehow cut off access, at least for some period of time,
mm-hmm.
that would give us give us enough jump that we could get a lot of people out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could block the entrance to the building, and everybody funnels up to the top, come in with helicopters and pull them off, and by the time folks would realize what was going on and start breaking through and then climb up to the top, you have a lot better chance of getting people out.
Yes.
And we essentially set up, I believe it was 32 structures. That included, obviously, the embassy, the Pittman building, which was sort of agency headquarters. And we kind of made some preparations. We took aerial photos and all of that and had these buildings designated and tried to encourage, you know, all of our people to congregate in those specific buildings. In other words, move out of the, you know, private residences, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, that worked fairly well. We had difficulty getting access to some of these buildings. And I got into one that was, oh, probably no more than a mile away from the airport. And there were still some, you know, USAID folks and people like that around. But, you know, the evacuation was going in earnest on the, you know, on the airplane side. The Air Force was hauling people out in droves. And I was able to get an apartment, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only reason I was able to get this apartment was they figured that if I was there, they'd have a ride out.
Mm-hmm.
Word of mouth, too. I eventually managed to get some more rooms for other folks, but it was like pulling teeth. And despite the fact that there were, you know, plenty of open apartments, but the sense was that, you know, Air America was different. You know, this was a USAID building, and therefore it was for USAID people, not for those Air America people. And so the next thing that I wanted to do was sort of make routine helicopter landings on these rooftops. And, the embassy was dead set against that. They absolutely refused to let us do it. I went ahead regardless, and I started commuting from the base, the airport, to the apartment. I remember the first night I landed up on the rooftop, and boy, I probably drew a crowd of a couple thousand people. The neighborhood, the streets were just full of people looking to see what the heck was going on. Here's this helicopter landing on the roof. But after about the second or third time, they didn't really pay any more attention. It was just a routine thing, and so they ignored it.
Yes, sir.
Which is exactly what I was hoping to accomplish.
Yes.
But that was the only place we were able to do that.
Did they say why they didn't want you to do that? Because that is a very, I mean, it's a logical thing to do.
Well, I think, you know, and it's hard to say. I think they were in denial. I don't think they liked the idea of somebody like myself, just one of those Air America pilots, thinks he knows something. He doesn't know anything. We've got all this intelligence, and we know what's going on. Because I remember, I think my last conversation with the ambassador, they were essentially saying that I was upsetting people unnecessarily, and that you know, he had good information that Saigon was off limits to the North Vietnamese; it would never be taken over, and therefore, the things that I was doing were just stirring the pot and upsetting people unnecessarily.
And this was the ambassador saying this. Who was providing him with the supposed good information? Do you know?
Well, you know, as I can determine, you know, it was through the agency and his advisors.
Okay.
I tend to suspect that he was maybe a little senile at that time and maybe didn't fully realize what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had a lot of misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is just supposition on my part that the agency chief down there, a fellow by the name of Tom Polgar, I believe was Hungarian. And the impression I had was that he had become close friends with the head of the Hungarian delegation, and that this was a source of a lot of his intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes sense that they would have such strong feelings like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my supposition. I don't know.
Interesting. When you mentioned earlier that, again, as you were developing this plan to evacuate from rooftops instead of from base areas and on the ground based on the Da Nang experience, and you said this would allow them to protect, to allow or to control access to the building, prevent mobs from coming in, and allow for a more, hopefully, a smoother evacuation and a safer evacuation. Who were the people that would prevent access to the building and control and engage in crowd control on the ground while you evacuated?
Well, good question, and I'm not sure that we really fully determined that. Obviously, at some of these buildings, they had, you know, military guards and mm-hmm. security people and things like that that would hopefully be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, though, it was felt that, you know, with the relatively small numbers of people, that we'd be able to get them off those roofs pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it would take time before, you know, people would realize what was going on, and then they'd have to break through the doors, and, you know, they should have been barricaded, and you could have blocked access, you know, in stages all the way up to the top.
Yes.
To buy time.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't any, specific arrangements made other than what was made at the individual buildings. Because they're all different, too.
Yes. Were there Americans? When you say the military guards protecting some of these buildings, were some of the Marines? Like, I know there were Marines at the embassy, but what about at the other buildings?
Yeah, I don't know if the Marines were at any of the other buildings.
Okay. And I take it that then the plan that you helped devise in terms of evacuating Saigon, that included, putting some materials, as you mentioned, some of the doors are supposed to be barricaded and things like that. Did that include pre-positioning stuff so that it would be easy for the people as they came up into the building to go ahead and barricade as they went so that it would slow down a mob if it did happen?
Quite frankly, I really didn't get involved in that part of it.
Oh, okay.
Do you know
who did?
Not specifically.
Okay.
My side really was the air side.
Yes, sir.
And this is what we need, and I kind of left that up to other folks.
Mm-hmm.
I was busy enough as it was.
I wasn't
going to get involved in all the nitty-gritty of it. Now,
mm-hmm.
I felt that certainly there were people that were far better qualified in those areas
mm-hmm.
to handle that.
How did the plan work? You know, when it came time to evacuate, there's that expression, no plan survives first contact.
Well,
did this one?
It actually worked very well.
Okay.
Quite frankly, despite all the problems that we had, had the other items that I had really wanted, the biggest one being fuel. Because what the plan was, and we had made two or three trips out to the ships to brief folks out there on what was going on. And essentially, the basic plan was that 6 hours before any evacuation, the Marines would come in and secure the facilities and all of that. And then Air America was supposed to be shuttling the people from these rooftop pads out to the airport. And from there, the military, with their Jolly Greens and H-46s and so forth, would take the people from there out to the ships. Because you were talking, I don't know, ships are probably 100 miles away. And unfortunately, one of my big concerns was alternate sources of fuel. And we found an old abandoned USAID building downtown that I felt would be ideal to store fuel. And we spent, in fact, Nikki Filippi, I believe, spent a day up there working on it with a crew. And to cut off access to the roof, it was sort of like a cantilevered roof. And so the plan was to cut off, you know, stairways, ladders, and so forth. And we'd put 55-gallon drums of fuel on the rooftop. And that was done, and I went in there with one load of fuel and was informed that if I was caught near that building, they'd probably shoot me down. And this was primarily from the Vietnamese, but I got no support from the embassy folks accomplishing anymore. And as a result, when the field was hit, they hit the fuel dump. And so we didn't have any other fuel. So what we had to do was we could run a couple shuttles downtown to the airport. Then we'd have to just load up with people and fly out to the ships to get fuel. Then fly all the way back. And you had enough fuel to do a couple more shuttles, and then you'd have to go back out to the ships again, which really constrained, you know, our ability to do what we needed to do. And amazingly enough, for the most part, I think, with just a few exceptions, essentially all the Americans did get out.
Now, when you said that they told you if you went near that building, you'd probably get shot down, this is the South Vietnamese saying this?
Yeah, yeah.
Did they say why?
No, there wasn't any explanations given. But it was just very typical of what was going on over there. I mean, there wasn't any good explanation for a lot of things. But it was just, can't do this, we don't want you to do it. And if you do, this is what's going to happen, type of thing. And we just didn't get the support.
Did you ever get an explanation from the embassy staff on why they didn't support this? I mean, forward positioning fuel is just a basic precaution.
No. Never got an explanation for anything from any of those people, quite frankly. And I wasn't particularly interested in hearing about
right.
Edwards anyways.
Right.
It was a real frustrating thing.
Yes, sir.
I was just so busy running around with different things, and one of the things came up, we had a lot of Filipino personnel, mostly mechanics, and a lot of them had been there for years and years and years, And they had families, and a lot of them they had, you know, Vietnamese families.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Air America and their folks, other than Americans, were in the bottom of the list for being evacuated. And a lot of the Filipinos' families, they had no passports, paperwork, or anything else like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it even tougher than to do anything. So the Philippines sent an LST over to Vung Tau to take these people out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought all their families down to Vung Tau, and the Vietnamese wouldn't let them go.
Mm-hmm.
They go down to the dock, and they said, uh-uh, you're not leaving. So now we had like 1,200 people down there on the beach, camped out. And obviously the our Filipino mechanics, particularly, they says, well, we're not leaving our families. And we're going to stay here until we know they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, that was going to adversely impact our operation. Because if they weren't working, we were going to be out of business pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
They were a necessary part of our operation.
Sure.
So I went down there and met with them, and the, I believe it was the Filipino ambassador was down there. And I met with he and his staff, and said, well, you know, what can we do about this? And I says, well, if they won't let you go out on the dock and go by boat out to the ship, why don't we just load them up on helicopters and we'll overfly them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and his staff was aghast. He said, oh, no, we can't do that. That'll be big trouble. The ambassador, to his credit, says, really? Would you do that? And I said, sure. So he said, let's do it. So the next day I got a couple more helicopters, and we got all those folks out there.
Wow.
And they were obviously very happy. And mm-hmm. said, well, you know, what can we do to repay you for all this? And I says, well, do you have any more room on your ship? And he says, oh, we could probably handle 200 or 300 more. I says, well, we got a lot of Vietnamese employees, but I don't know how they're going to get out. Would you mind taking them?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, sure, he says, but we would need to have, if we can get a letter from the embassy, the U.S. embassy, stating that they will accept responsibility for them when we get to the Philippines, we'll do it. So I called over the embassy and got a hold of a fellow by the name of Jacobson, who's sort of like the ambassador's secretary,
mm-hmm.
and explained to him what we needed. And his response was, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. And I was just, oh, I couldn't even see straight for
mm-hmm.
2 minutes. And I finally asked him, I says, well, could you do me another favor, man? He says, well, what's that? I says, would it be possible to get a photo of yourself? He says, yeah, I guess so. I says, what do you need that for? I says, well, I want to make, about 100 copies or so and pass it around to all the rest of the crews. So when it comes time to go, we'll know who not to pick up. Hung up on him. Oh, I was furious. So we didn't get the folks out there. And, you know, that was just the type of thing that seemed to go on constantly. Air America had the lowest priority. We couldn't get our people out of Da Nang on Air America airplanes that were sent up there, you know, to haul other people out. We could haul them out, but we couldn't haul our people out.
Why?
Priorities. I mean, we did it anyways.
Mm-hmm. But you were told not to.
Well, essentially we were told, this aircraft is for these people here going out. And, we got into a big harangue with Bart Green, the base manager in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about, you know, the seatbelt rule. And that you cannot put any more people on an aircraft that you have seatbelts for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, wait a minute. We get an evacuation going on here. This is serious business.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, don't you put any more people on that plane unless you have enough seatbelts. Of course, we ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, it was that foolishness that constantly went on, and what it really amounted to was that I don't believe anybody recognized what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They just couldn't see the forest for the trees.
I'm curious, were there any other significant air presence? Was there any other significant air presence in South Vietnam at this time?
Of what nature?
Helicopters. And I mean, you mentioned that the Air Force did have some Jolly Greens, but I mean, who was doing, you know, how, in terms of the overall air mission for the evacuation, who was doing the most flying? Or was it evenly split up?
Oh, that's hard to say. I think Air America did the most flying,
mm-hmm.
probably hour-wise, because the big plan of the Marines coming in 6 hours before any evacuation failed,
mm-hmm.
and the evacuation already started, and I flew out to the ship and got a hold of Marine General Carey, who was in charge of the Marines, and I says, where are you guys? We need you to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're being overrun. And he says, my hands are tied. I have to get approval from the ambassador before we can come in. And he hasn't given it to us yet. And, you know, that was the type of thing we were battling with. I think it was, I don't know, maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon before they ever got there. And then we had been flying for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Hauling people out before the military showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think my last flight was, I don't know, maybe 11 o'clock at night. I started about 4 in the morning. And they said, that's it. Shut down. And I think Marines, and I believe the Air Force had some helicopters over there, too, off the ships.
Mm-hmm.
And they flew for maybe a few hours after that. They primarily pulled people off the embassy and mm-hmm. out of the airport.
About how many Air America pilots were a part of that evacuation? Do you know?
Oh, I can't think of the exact number. Maybe somewhere is around 20.
Mm-hmm.
Probably around that. Well, there's probably more than that if you're counting, you know, the airplanes. And of course, the airplanes all pretty much they left early in the day,
mm-hmm.
and then the helicopters just. I mean, the airplanes went. It was a one-way trip for them.
Okay. About how many planes left? Do you recall?
Probably a dozen or so.
Mm-hmm. What kind of aircraft were they, the one-way planes?
Well, mostly, you know, C-46s, C-47s, Volpars,
mm-hmm.
Maybe Caribou. And they went in different directions. there was word that, you know, Thailand wouldn't allow them to land. But some of them went to Thailand. Others went down to Malaysia.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear why the Thai government didn't want aircraft to land there? If for no other reason, just to refuel and move on?
Oh, I think it was just political concerns.
Okay.
And, you know, it was interesting. There was somebody wrote an article in American Log here a couple issues ago. I think he had Adams had something to say about it. And a couple of them landed in Tak Lee, which is up north of Bangkok, and some others landed in Bangkok itself.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them got held up for quite a while, and others just parked and went downtown. So it was kind of willy-nilly. But I think for the most part it was strictly political considerations.
Okay. And if you were to guesstimate again about how many military aircraft eventually became involved in the evacuation from what you saw?
Hard to say.
Yeah.
Maybe 30 or 40.
Okay.
I really don't know because we were just so busy doing our thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, having been out to the ship for a couple of visits, meeting some of the people, thought I had a little better handle, and they had a little better handle on things, but they didn't. And as I was coming in on my last trip, you know, they're telling me, oh, what a great job you guys have done, and this, that, and everything else. And I landed and shut down, and security guards came over and put your hands up.
What?
And, you know, I had weapons and things like that that I'd stashed that I figured if I got trapped there in Saigon, that was probably going to be my last resort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had a sawed-off shotgun and a Car 15 and a grenade launcher. And they'd given out weapons that morning by the it was there at the airport compound.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up two 9mm Berettas. These are all brand new. And they says, here, take whatever you want. So I stuffed them and got out to the ship and put your hands up. And they took the big weapons and they threw them over the side, which I thought was really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't make any sense. The pistols, they says, well, we'll put these in the armory. We'll keep them there for you. Well, I didn't really care to see another weapon in, as long as I lived, quite frankly, at that point in time.
Yes, sir.
Didn't make any difference to me.
Mm-hmm.
But they ushered me down into the hold of the ship. And I was fortunately rescued by the Navy Lieutenant Commander, who offered to share his room with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little more pleasant. And I told him, he had an interest in weapons. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I don't care if I see another weapon again. But I've got two Beretta 9mm pistols down in the armory. And if you want them, they're yours. And I said, I'll make you out a bill of sale or whatever you need. And so we did that. And he went down there. And he was told that, we threw those overboard. So it was rather disappointing.
Yes,
and,
sir.
We were essentially, the pilots, I think, for the most part, treated just like refugees once we got aboard the ships. And we were pretty much cut off from all information and intelligence or anything else like that until we got to the Philippines.
Now, when you were approached when you shut down your aircraft and were told to put your hands up, was this at gunpoint?
Oh, I don't know if they pointed their guns at me or not, but essentially they just wanted to frisk me. Make sure that I didn't have any hidden weapons or anything like that. I don't know what they, you know, thought we were going to do, if we were going to commandeer their ship or something. It was all pretty bizarre.
And the aircraft you were flying, was this a clearly marked Air America aircraft?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, did other pilots land on the same ship with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was, I landed on the command ship, the Blue Ridge, because that's where I'd done my briefing and so forth previously. And I, you know, knew a few people there.
And were they treated the same way when they arrived? Pretty much?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the unfortunate part was they didn't have a lot of room, just had a little small deck in the back. And so they kept throwing the ships overboard. I wasn't going to let them throw mine over. And since I was sort of the last one coming, you know, there really wasn't any need for them to do so. But that was just so bizarre. Because they obviously, they had space in the carriers and what have you, that they could have salvaged these aircraft. You know, it was just an outrageous waste.
Do you know what the rationale was behind pitching those aircraft overboard?
Probably a lack of information and understanding. I don't know, it escapes me. You know, I would really like to get into the heads of some of those folks and find out just what their thinking was at that time.
And what, did that? Do you know if that came down literally from the captain of the ships? Would that happen? Was it? You know?
Oh, I would have to think so. I mean, the captain's in charge. You know, on a ship, he's the guy.
Right.
He's the one who says do this or do that.
And. Were some of these aircraft that were, again, tossed overboard, were these Air America as well?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah. In fact, I got this commander that I stayed with, he had a movie camera. So he took pictures of, probably three or four or five ditchings. And I got a copy of that. And it was great teaching element for how not to and how to ditch helicopters.
Okay.
Because what they did initially, pilot would land, and of course, there was both Vietnamese and ours, and of course, the Vietnamese stole a couple of our helicopters right off the bat before our folks could even get out to the field. And they weren't real adept. And one of them sort of crashed into the side of the ship. The thought was, oh, that's one of those inept Air America pilots. But what they would do, they'd land on the ship, and they'd give them a Mae West, and they'd take the doors off, and they'd say, ditch it. And it was pretty interesting. There's three or four Vietnamese. I think they got one guy that he ditched probably half a dozen for him. And every which way you could think of. And then one of our guys, Dave Kendall, he landed, and of course the radios didn't work, and he says, well, you can't fly that thing around here without radios. Ditch it. And so Dave is out there trying to figure out how he's going to do it, and he decided he'd go real low and slow and get it moving forward slowly and then jump out, and it would fly off. Unfortunately, that upset the center of gravity, and as soon as he jumped out, the helicopter started backing up, and it hit tail first and probably within a couple feet of his head.
Oh, my goodness.
And he fortunately wasn't hurt, but that made for a pretty exciting picture.
Wow. Was anybody injured during the ditching?
I think one guy broke an arm.
Okay.
And that was about it. It was pretty amazing.
That's lucky.
So bizarre, because they had a boat,
uh-huh.
you know, running around to pick the guys up.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, those guys were at great risk from mm-hmm. flying debris and everything else. The helicopter hits the water. I mean, it just literally starts tearing itself apart.
Yes.
Pieces flying all over. You know, it was not a well thought out
no.
operation at all.
And as you pointed out, there was an aircraft carrier in the vicinity with plenty of space for these aircraft.
Should have been.
Yeah. Wow. What, you know, when you finally settled down after all this on board this ship on your way to the Philippines, what was going through your mind? Do you remember?
Oh, it was just a very frustrating scenario. And, of course, we were pretty much kept incommunicado.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, other than we flew the aircraft off the ship when we got into the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
I didn't fly for probably 5 or 6 years after that. And looking back on it, I think it was pretty much psychological.
Mm-hmm.
I was really kind of depressed
mm-hmm.
over it. Terrible loss of lives and equipment and money and everything else over there for nothing. And it was all kind of related to flying.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I got involved in air ambulance operations that I had any interest at all in doing any more flying.
Did you find that new work to be rewarding?
Oh, very much so. And that's probably the only kind of flying that would have gotten me
mm-hmm.
back in.
Did you get a chance to talk to many other Air America pilots on the trip over when you, again, on board ship to the Philippines? Eventually, did you guys get together and sit down and kind of hash things out?
There wasn't a whole lot of opportunities.
Okay.
We were kind of spread about, and we were pretty well restricted. You know, access
mm-hmm.
on the ship. You know, we were restricted to certain areas, and we weren't all in the same area.
Okay.
Like, I was up here with this commander, and most of the guys were down in the hold someplace. And
mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a whole lot of interaction.
Right. Later on, when you were able to meet up with some of your fellow Air America pilots, did you talk about this experience, or did you just kind of avoid the subject?
Oh, yeah, we talk about it. Yeah. And, you know, pretty much everybody was frustrated by the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was really the bottom line.
Did everybody get out?
Essentially, all of our people did. I mean, there were some, obviously, local Vietnamese. There was... You know, there was a few Americans left there. There was one agency guy that didn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
But amazingly, you know, probably 99% did,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was truly remarkable.
Yes, sir. That agency person who did not make it out, is his name public knowledge? Do you know?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and I can't remember. I think he eventually got out.
Okay.
But that's probably a story in itself.
Yes, sir. What do you think was the most important thing you took away from that experience in Southeast Asia that was maybe important for you later in life?
Don't depend on other people to do things for you. That was the toughest lesson.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, and I hate to say it, but don't depend on the U.S. government to look out for your interests. And I hate to say that, too.
Yes, sir.
But I think we were looked upon. upon as necessary evils, we were expendable. And I didn't really feel like there was an adequate appreciation for what they did.
That's
over there. I mean, some of these guys did some really remarkable things.
Mm-hmm.
A great things for themselves, and never were given the recognition. I mean, even today, you know, you'll see clips of you know, that helicopter on the rooftop, and it embarrassingly be referred to as, you know, a Marine Corps helicopter or a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that you'll even see, oh, well, this was an Air America helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been that recognition either.
Do you think that things are changing in terms of the recognition that Air America deserves to receive?
Oh, I see some very small steps in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Even, I think, with this upcoming reunion where the agency is sort of going to formally recognize
yes.
Air America. So, over the years, it's probably less of a bad word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I meet more and more people now that maybe have a little better appreciation. Whereas in the past, the only thing that conjured up in people's minds about America was a bunch of drug-running mercenaries.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that perception was not helped very much by that movie, Air America.
No, not at all. Yeah, that was pretty sad.
Yes, sir. If you had it all to do over again, would you do anything different?
Oh, probably not. I don't have any regrets for what I did or how we did it. You know, I might have done a few things in a little different manner, but given the situation, the timing, and the lack of information and experience and all the rest of that, probably did as well as we could have done.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we as a nation should take away from this experience? Something that maybe we haven't yet learned from the experience in Southeast Asia?
Don't underestimate the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And don't politicize it. And that, I think, was the biggest problem was, you know, it was a political war. And, run by the politicians, not by the military.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening didn't need to happen.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Oh, I'm probably talked out right now.
Okay.
I need to get off here anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll end it here then. This will end the interview with Marius Burke. Thank you very much, sir.